show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to a better late than never edition of Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid. It is debate night. Debate night in America. You got to wonder if Mussolini will drop a puck at this one or something. No telling. Okie dokie. So it's about 16 minutes to showtime. John Fox and Peter Godbold will be joining presently. And instead of trying to run off on the evening's news, we'll just wait for wait for the debate to get started. But I've got something here that Lottie from the chat room, one of our chat room moderators, sent along last night. And I know that Malloy read it last night. And I know there's a lot of overlap in our audiences. But I got to tell you, I'm going to read it again. Because there are places where there isn't overlap, and if you happen to miss it last night on his program, then I want to make sure that you get it on this one. So, without further ado, what we're talking about here is one of the single most brilliant essays that I have read in a long, long time, and I'm terribly grateful to Lottie for sending it along. The name of the essay, and you know how I feel about reading to you guys, but this is one of those that I want to make sure goes out into the ether and is findable and hearable, because this is a clarion wake-up call to all of us. This is so much, so eloquently said, of what I have been talking about for so very long that I don't feel it would, I don't want to just say, hey, go here and no offense, trust you to go read it. I want to make sure that I do some little part to make sure that it is given life and an expansion of audience. Again, this is just profound. Sleptone.com, SLEPTON.com is where this came from. And apparently it found its way there from redroom.com. It is an essay by someone by the name of Tim Wise, and I've got to look up who this person is, because What a touch Tim Wise has with the language where this is concerned. But we'll just go into this before the debate starts, just as a sort of an appetizer for what we're about to hear, especially in light of what we may very well expect from old Lumpy McHoover, old 894. The title of the piece is This Is How Fascism Comes, Reflections on the Cost of Silence. For those who have seen the ugliness and heard the vitriol emanating from the mouths of persons attending McCain-Palin rallies this past week, what with their demands to kill Barack Obama, slurs that he is a terrorist and a traitor, and paranoid delusions about his crypto-Muslim designs on America, please know this. This is how fascism comes to an ostensible democracy. If it comes, And if those whose poisonous, unhinged verbiage has been so ubiquitous this week have any say over it, it surely will. This is how it will happen. Not with tanks and jackbooted stormtroopers, but carried in the hearts of men and women, dressed in comfortable shoes with baseball caps and what would Jesus do wristbands. It will be heralded by updos, designer glasses, you betcha folksiness, and a disdain for big words or hard consonants. If fascism comes, it will spring from the soil of middle America, from people known as values voters, but whose values are toxic. From simple folk whose simplicity, far, far from being admirable, is better labeled ignorance. From all-American types whose patriotism is a dagger pointed at the very heart of the national interest. For it so forsakes all the best principles upon which the Republic was founded, choosing instead to elevate and ratify the narrow-mindedness, the bigotry, and the intolerance that also marked our country's origins. If fascism comes, it will be ushered in by tailgaters at the big football game, by Joe Sixpack, who upon finishing his sixth beer and belching forth the stench of a mediocre life lived, will gladly announce its arrival so long as it comes with a steady supply of Pabst Blue Ribbon and hot dogs on the grill and giant foam hands with a Weir Number One finger, some Mardi Gras beads and a good titty bar. If fascism comes, it will dress like a hockey mom or a NASCAR dad. It will believe Toby Keith to be an artiste, Larry the Cable Guy to be a comic, and that the world was made in 6 literal days less than 6,000 years ago. If fascism comes, it will come from the small towns, the one Sarah Palin, quoting a famous racist and Jew-hater, said, grow good people, and which occasionally do, but which just as often grow provincial, isolated, fearful, and superstitious ones. If fascism comes, it will come from faux populism, from anti-immigrant hysteria, from persons who have more guns in their homes than books, or whose books, when they have them, are principally volumes of the Left Behind series, several different copies of the Bible, and a plethora of romance novels. If fascism comes, it will be welcomed, lock, stock, and barrel, by persons who pray at every meal to a god they visualize as white, whose son they also think was white, and who they believe is going to rapture them all into the sky upon the blowing of some heavenly trumpet. After which point, all those who don't think as they think will be burned in an eternal lake of fire. Their vision and version of God is itself fascistic. To love a god who would do such a thing is to love an abusive, sadistic, and evil deity after all. So it should come as little surprise that their conception of the state would be equally authoritarian or worse. If fascism comes, it will be at the behest of those who hold a contempt for what they call book learning, who prefer presidents who mispronounce basic words because they make them feel smarter, and who are looking for nothing so much as a commander-in-chief with whom they would enjoy having a beer or two, or 12, at some backyard barbecue. If fascism comes, it will be interviewed lovingly on talk radio by hosts whose cerebral inadequacies are more than made up for by their bellicosity, their bombast, their willingness to shout down those with whom they cannot argue, for argument requires knowledge, and this is a commodity with which they have not even a passing familiarity. If fascism comes, it will come wrapped in red, white, and blue, carrying a crucifix and a shotgun, projecting its own sexual confusion and insecurity onto others, substituting volume for veracity and rage for reason, and landing on the New York Times bestseller list as a result. If fascism comes, it will have a pajama party at Ann Coulter's house, pop pills with Rush Limbaugh, and go gay bashing with Michael Savage all in the same weekend, and it will refuse to learn another language or get a passport, because doing either of those would make one cosmopolitan, which is just another word for faggot. If fascism comes, it will come because a lot of people who aren't like the folks I'm talking about here won't stand up to the ones who are. Because we're too busy, don't want to make waves,
don't want to lose friends or alienate family. It will come, in other words, because those who know better are cowards, more concerned with getting along, making nice, and being liked than with telling the truth, calling out evil, and saving their country. If fascism comes, it will come because of the silence and thus collaboration of those who think themselves good and certainly superior to the knuckle-draggers they can see on YouTube at the McCain rallies, but who in the end are no better and in some ways worse than they. After all, at least fascists stand up for what they believe in. They are telling us, in no uncertain terms, what kind of United States they want and are willing to fight for and maybe even to kill for. But many progressives, many liberals, many of the so-called enlightened are doing nothing at all. If fascism comes, it will come because those liberals thought voting for Barack Obama was all they needed to do. It will come because they allowed themselves to believe that politics is what a person does every 4 years, but not at work, and not in the neighborhood, and not at the dinner table. Meanwhile, know-nothings, filled with hate, nurtured on racial and religious bigotry, and who have overdosed on the kind of hyper-nationalism that has always proved fatal to those places foolish or craven enough to allow it a foothold, talk of their visions for America at every opportunity. They raise their kids on that sickness. They build churches whose very foundation is rooted in that cancerous rot, and they will think nothing of steamrolling those who get in their way. So when exactly do we fight back? When do we say enough? When do we stand up to our relative or friend who sends us the email about Obama being a Manchurian candidate or Al-Qaeda sympathizer or the one about the decency of Midwestern flood victims as opposed to those stranded after Katrina or about how God was punishing New Orleans because of its tolerance of homosexuality and tell them what we think? Namely, that they are a bunch of racist, heterosexist loons whose friendship or familial connection we neither want nor intend to pursue unless they get help. When do we decide that we love our country and humanity too much to allow these people one more day of decent sleep, one more day of self-assured confidence in their craziness and the willingness of the rest of us to just take it? When do we decide that every irrational, geezoid, racist thing that comes from their mouths will be attacked, will be rebutted, until they can no longer take for granted the ability to say any of it in mixed company without being called out? Why, in the face of the fascism they would surely introduce if given the chance, are we intent on being so nice? Why are we not more offended? Offended not merely at what such persons say about others, like Obama or Latino immigrants or whatever, but even about we who look like them. After all, their open exhortations of racism presuppose that they are speaking for us, and that this kind of brain-dead ventilation is something to which all white folks should aspire, as though it were virtually the essence of enlightenment. If fascism comes, it will come because we did not see in their actions a sufficient threat, or because we allowed ourselves to believe that it couldn't come, that our institutions were too strong, our people too good for that to happen. If it comes, it will come because we allowed ourselves to believe the rosy and optimistic version of America spun by Obama without tempering that optimism with a clear-headed appraisal of the way that, sadly, a still huge number of Americans actually think. Because we allowed the vehicle of our hopes to outrun the headlights of truth. Because we convinced ourselves that we actually lived in the country of our aspirations rather than the nation we have at present. And if fascism doesn't come, if, rather, democracy does, it will come because good people said no. It will come because we saw in this moment the opportunity to demand the full measure of our humanity and to pour it forth upon the national soil. It will be because we understood that democracy isn't what you have. It's what you do. But if we are to issue that demand, if we are to stand straight and fulfill the potential we possess to do justice, We had best exercise the option quickly, for the opponents of justice are on the move. They are preparing to enter on the winds of our silence and indifference and complacency. Let them find no quarter here. Amen and amen. Thank you, Tim Wise, whoever and wherever you are. We are almost on top of the 9 p.m. hour here on the East Coast. And you know what? I experienced a little bit of the reason I read that was because I experienced a little bit of it just this evening. While waiting to go to the meeting, I stopped at the little pharmacy we have here. I stepped up to check on a prescription. And the pharmacist, who is a fundamentalist, I can tell from the Jesus music that he plays most of the time when he's there. He looks at me and says, you know, because I just walked up and he says, isn't that right? Because we do that around here. You know, ain't that right? You ask of a stranger. Oh, heck yeah. So I did that. Oh, shoot. Absolutely. And he says, because that's what them liberals want. Those liberals want socialism. We can't have socialism in America, can we? And I just looked at him and said, fine by me if we do. We're already driving on socialized roads, drinking socialized water. George W. Bush has the finest socialized medicine that money can buy. And so does the entirety of Congress, the Supreme Court. Don't know why it's not good enough for the rest of us. We got socialized banks now. And that's why I shared that with you, because I at least talked back. And I know you do too. And once in a while, it's good to have a little inspiration and a little knowledge that what we're doing is, by God, the right thing to do. Now, okay, thanks, Lottie, in the chat room. Now I know who Tim Wise is, and my ignorance is cured. One of the most prominent anti-racism writers and activists in the U.S., having given lectures from 1995 to the present in 48 different states and on over 500 college campuses, having trained a multitude of teachers, corporate employees, nonprofit organizations, and law enforcement officers in methods for dismantling racism in their institutions. And he is brilliant. Born in Nashville, by the way. The South is responsible for a great deal of good, in addition to some pretty serious evils. Nice to see Tim Wise creating some of that balance. Hey, John.
G'day, mate. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How about you?
That was an amazing piece of writing you read. I'm not sure what to expect tonight. I think it's going to be more of the boring same, because I think just Obama's going to deflate McCain by just looking presidential and being calm and steady, and whatever McCain came armed with, he won't pull it out. But if he does, I think all bets are off. But the chances of that are pretty slim.
Oh, heavens to Betsy. I mean, I would think that by now McCain knows that we know about the skeletons in his closet. I mean,
yeah.
You want to talk about William Ayers? Let's talk about William Timmons.
Well, it looks like we're actually getting ready to start. Should we go to the feed?
Let's do, please.
All right.
And hopefully,
coming on stage.
And by the way, hopefully Peter Godbold will join us presently.
No worries. You got enough feed there?
I'm in good shape.
Okay.
Gentlemen, welcome. By now we've heard all the talking points, so let's try to tell the people tonight some things that they haven't heard. Let's get to it. Another very bad day on Wall Street, as both of you know. Both of you proposed new plans this week to address the economic crisis. Senator McCain, you proposed a $52 billion plan that includes new tax cuts on capital gains, tax breaks for seniors, write-offs for stock losses, among other things. Senator Obama, you proposed $60 billion in tax cuts for middle-income and lower-income people, more tax breaks to create jobs, new spending for public works projects to create jobs. I will ask both of you, why is your plan better than his? Senator McCain, you go first.
Well, let me say, Bob, thank you, and thanks to Hofstra. And by the way, our beloved Nancy Reagan is in the hospital tonight. Our thoughts and prayers are going with you. It's good to see you again, Senator Obama. Americans,
you got to expect that, Bob.
Right now,
I know, but I ain't gonna like it.
They're hurting and they're angry. They're innocent victims of greed and excess on Wall Street, and as well as Washington D.C. And they're angry, and they have every reason to be angry, and they want this country to go in a new direction. And there are elements of my proposal that you just outlined, which I won't repeat. But we also have to have a short-term fix, in my view, and long-term fixes. Let me just talk to you about one of the short-term fixes. The catalyst for this housing crisis was the Fannie and Freddie Mae that caused the subprime lending situation that now caused the housing market in America to collapse. I am convinced that until we reverse this continued decline in home ownership and put a floor under it, and so that people have not only the hope and belief they can stay in their homes and realize the American dream, but that value will come up. Now, we have allocated $750 billion. Let's take $300 of that billion and go in and buy those home loan mortgages and negotiate with those people in their homes, 11 million homes or more, so that they can afford to pay the mortgage, stay in their home. Now, I know the criticism of this. Well, what about the citizen that stayed in their homes, that paid their mortgage payments? It doesn't help that person in their home if the next-door neighbor's house is abandoned. And so we've got to reverse this. We ought to put the homeowners first, and I am disappointed that Secretary Paulson and others have not made that their first priority.
All right. Senator Obama.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Hofstra University and the people of New York for hosting us tonight, and it's wonderful to join Senator McCain again, and thank you, Bob. I think everybody understands at this point that we are experiencing the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. And the financial rescue plan that Senator McCain and I have supported is a important first step. And I pushed for some core principles, making sure the taxpayers can get their money back if they're putting money up, making sure that CEOs are not enriching themselves through this process. And I think that it's going to take some time to work itself out. But what we haven't yet seen is a rescue package for the middle class, because the fundamentals of the economy were weak even before this latest crisis. So I've proposed four specific things that I think can help. Number one, let's focus on jobs. I want to end the tax breaks for companies that are shipping jobs overseas and provide a tax credit for every company that's creating a job right here in America. Number two, let's help families right away by providing them a tax cut, a middle-class tax cut for people making less than $200,000, and let's allow them to access their IRA accounts without penalty if they're experiencing a crisis. Now, Senator McCain, I agree with your idea that we've got to help homeowners. That's why we included in the financial package a proposal to get homeowners in a position where they can renegotiate their mortgages. I disagree with Senator McCain in how to do it, because the way Senator McCain has designed his plan, it could be a giveaway to banks if we're buying full price for mortgages that now are worth a lot less, and we don't want to waste taxpayer money. And we've got to get the financial package working much quicker than it's been working. Last point I want to make, though, we've got some long-term challenges in this economy that have to be dealt with. We've got to fix our energy policy that's giving our wealth away. We've got to fix our health care system, and we've got to invest in our education system for every young person to be able to learn.
All right. And would you like to ask him a question?
No. I would like to mention that a couple of days ago, Senator Obama was out in Ohio, and he had an encounter with a guy who's a plumber. His name is Joe Wurzelberger. Joe wants to buy the business that he's been in for all these years, work 10, 12 hours a day. And he wanted to buy the business, but he looked at your tax plan and he saw that he was going to pay much higher taxes. You were going to put him in a higher tax bracket, which was going to increase his taxes, which was going to cause him not to be able to employ people, which Joe was trying to realize the American dream. Now, Senator Obama talks about the very, very rich. Joe, I want to tell you, I'll not only help that you buy that business that you worked your whole life for and be able, and I'll keep
my
your
wife
taxes
will buy
low,
it for
I'll
you.
I'll provide available and affordable
and bring
health
you a
care
keg.
For you and your employees, and I will not have, I will not stand for a tax increase on the small business income. 50% of small business income tax is taxes are paid by small businesses. That's 16 million jobs in America. And what you want to do to Joe the plumber and millions more like him is have their taxes increased and not be able to realize the American dream of owning their own business. That's what Joe believes.
He's been watching some ads.
Believing, not knowing, believing.
I'm actually going to do I think tax policy is a major difference between Senator McCain and myself. And we both want to cut taxes.
I have one.
The difference is who we want to cut taxes for. Now, Senator McCain, the centerpiece of his economic proposal is to provide $200 billion in additional tax breaks to some of the wealthiest corporations in America. ExxonMobil and other oil companies, for example, would get an additional $4 billion in tax breaks. What I've said is I want to provide a tax cut for 95% of working Americans. 95%. If you make less than $250,000 a year, then you will not see your income tax go up, your capital gains tax go up, your payroll tax, not one dime. And 95% of working families, 95% of you out there, will get a tax cut. In fact, independent studies have looked at our respective plans and have concluded that I provide three times the amount of tax relief to middle-class families than Senator McCain does. Now, the conversation I had with Joe the plumber, what I essentially said to him was, 5 years ago, when you weren't in a position to buy your business, you needed a tax cut then. And what I want to do is to make sure that the plumber, the nurse, the firefighter, the teacher, the young entrepreneur who doesn't yet have money, I want to give them a tax break now. And that requires us to make some important choices. Last point I'll make about small businesses, not only do 98% of small businesses make less than $250,000, but I also want to give them additional tax breaks because they are the drivers of the economy. They produce the most jobs.
You know what Senator Obama ended up his conversation with Joe the plumber? We need to spread the wealth around. In other words, we're going to take Joe's money, give it to Senator Obama, and let him spread the wealth around. I want Joe the plumber to spread that wealth around. You told him you wanted to spread the wealth around. The whole premise behind Senator Obama's plans are class warfare. Let's spread.
Oh, my God. John.
I want small business.
Yeah.
Class warfare. Kiss my
Even increase.
Who's been playing class warfare for the past since 1980?
Taxes right now. Why would you want to do
that?
That
would be the Republican Party, and they're winning.
When we have such a tough time, when these small business people like Joe the plumber are going to create jobs, unless you take that money from him and spread the wealth around.
Okay,
I'm not going to.
Sure.
We're not going to do that in my administration.
If I can answer the question, number one, I want to cut taxes for 95% of Americans. Now, it is true that my friend and supporter Warren Buffett, for example, could afford to pay a little more in taxes.
We're talking about
in order to give additional tax cuts to Joe the plumber before he was at the point where he could make $250,000. I think ExxonMobil, which made $12 billion record profits over the last several quarters, they can afford to pay a little more so that ordinary families who are hurting out there, they're trying to figure out how they're going to afford food, how they're going to save for their kids' college education. They need a break. So, look, nobody likes taxes. I would prefer that none of us had to pay taxes, including myself. But ultimately, we've got to pay for the core investments that make this economy strong. And
if nobody likes taxes, let's not raise anybody's taxes.
Well, I don't
okay?
mind paying a
The fact is that businesses in America today are paying the second highest tax rate of anywhere in the world. our tax rates for business in America.
Now, there he goes lying again.
Ireland, it's 11.
Well, and he's so major, Bob. It's amazing.
Where they can create jobs and where they can do best in business.
We need because the rate may be the second highest, but the effective rate is among the lowest because of the breaks we give corporate America.
We need to encourage business, create jobs.
And this just shows you who's on the side of the lobbyists.
Right, let's go to another topic. It's related, so if you have other things you want to say, you can get back to that. This question goes to you first, Senator Obama. We found out yesterday that this year's deficit will reach an astounding record high, $455 billion. Some experts say it could go to $1 trillion next year. Both of you have said you want to reduce the deficit, but the nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget ran the numbers on both of your proposals, and they say the cost of your proposals, even with the savings you claim can be made, each will add more than $200 billion to the deficit. Aren't you both ignoring reality? Won't some of the programs you're proposing have to be trimmed, postponed, even eliminated? Give us some specifics on what you're going to cut back, Senator Obama.
Well, first of all, I think it's important for the American public to understand that the $750 billion rescue package, if it's structured properly, and as president I will make sure it's structured properly, means that ultimately taxpayers get their money back. And that's important to understand. But there is no doubt that we've been living beyond our means, and we're going to have to make some adjustments. Now, what I've done throughout this campaign is to propose a net spending cut. I haven't made a promise about...
You're going to have to cut some of these programs, sir.
Absolutely. So let me get to that. What I want to emphasize, though, is that I have been a strong proponent of pay-as-you-go. Every dollar that I've proposed an additional cut, so that it matches. And some of the cuts, just to give you an example, we spend $15 billion a year on subsidies to insurance companies. It doesn't, under the Medicare plan, it doesn't help seniors get any better. It's not improving our health care system. It's just a giveaway. We need to eliminate a whole host of programs that don't work. And I want to go through the federal budget line by line, page by page. Programs that don't work, we should cut. Programs that we need, we should make them work better. Now, what is true is that Senator McCain and I have a difference in terms of the need to invest in America and the American people. I mentioned health care earlier. If we make investments now so that people have coverage, that we are preventing diseases, that will save on Medicare and Medicaid in the future. If we invest in a serious energy policy, that will save in the amount of money we're borrowing from China to send to Saudi Arabia. If we invest now in our young people and their ability to go to college, that will allow them to drive this economy into the 21st century. But what is absolutely true is that once we get through this economic crisis and some of the specific proposals to get us out of this slump, that we're not going to be able to go back to our profligate ways. And we're going to have to embrace a culture and an ethic of responsibility, all of us, corporations, the federal government,
you know, John,
and individuals out there who may be living beyond their means.
What we're hearing here is the success that the Republican Party has had in framing the debate for 30 years.
But, you know, so far this has kind of like been the best of the three debates. There's a bit more back and forth going on, but... So, again, obviously, it's really weird. The new guy looks like the mature guy, and he's speaking to America in a thoughtful fashion and being honest, which is something that we haven't had, and McCain's continuing this fear.
And the point is,
you know, bull campaign, and I just... I think it looks so unbelievably hollow.
Okay, what would I cut? I would have, first of all,
a funding
freeze, okay? That some people say that's a hatchet. That's a hatchet, and then I would get out a scalpel, okay? Because we have presided...
See, I'll go hard and not think. Oh, and then I'll go back and tweak it.
We have presided over the largest increase in government since the Great Society. A government spending has gone completely out of control. $10 trillion debt we're given to our kids... $500 billion.
Who's responsible for that, for the love of God? He is. Mr. Vote with Bush 90% of the time. He is.
Well, one of them would be the marketing assistance program. Another one would be a number of subsidies for ethanol. I oppose subsidies for ethanol because I thought it distorted the market and created inflation. Senator Obama supported those subsidies. I would eliminate the tariff on imported sugarcane-based ethanol from Brazil. I know how to save billions. I saved the taxpayer $6.8 billion by fighting a deal for a couple of years, as you might recall. It was a sweetheart deal between an aircraft manufacturer, DOD, and people ended up in jail. But I would fight for a line item veto, and I would certainly veto every earmarked pork barrel bill. Senator Obama has asked for nearly $1 billion in pork barrel earmarked projects, including $3 million for an overhead projector.
Oh, please beat his ass on this one. Please.
Cut out all the pork.
Well,
do you know about the overhead projector, John?
We do have disagreement about
across the
board
planetarium.
Spending. It sounds good. It's proposed periodically.
An educational device.
Happen. And, in fact, an across-the-board spending freeze is a hatchet, and we do need a scalpel because there are some programs that don't work at all. There are some programs that are underfunded, and I want to make sure that we are focused on those programs that work. Now, Senator McCain talks a lot about earmarks. That's one of the centerpieces of his campaign. Earmarks account for 0.5% of the total federal budget. There's no doubt that the system needs reform, and there are a lot of screwy things that we end up spending money on, and they need to be eliminated. But it's not going to solve the problem. Now, the last thing I think we have to focus on is a little bit of history, just so that we understand what we're doing going forward. When President Bush came into office, we had a budget surplus, and the national debt was a little over $5 trillion. It has doubled over the last 8 years, and we are now looking at a deficit of well over $500 billion. So one of the things that I think we have to recognize is pursuing the same kinds of policies that we pursued over the last 8 years is not going to bring down the deficit, and frankly, Senator McCain voted for 4 out of 5 of President Bush's budgets. We've got to take this in a new direction. That's what I propose as president.
Do either of you think you can balance the budget in 4 years? You have said previously you thought you could, Senator McCain.
Sure I do.
You can still do that?
Yeah. Senator Obama, I am not President Bush. If you wanted to run against President Bush, you should have run 4 years ago. I'm going to give a new direction to this economy in this country. Senator Obama talks about voting for budgets. He voted twice for a budget.
It's the Eddie Haskell syndrome again.
Increases the tax of individuals making $42,000 a year. Of course we can take a hatchet and a scalpel to this budget. It's completely out of control. The mayor of New York, Mayor Bloomberg, just...
this jackass wants to balance, if he balances the budget, he wants to balance it on our backs, John.
They're doing it all over America because they have to, because they have to balance their budgets. I will balance our budgets, and I will get them, and I will reduce this.
You're not going to balance the Pentagon budget, are you, Bomber John?
Creation of energy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Americans are hurting tonight, and they're angry, and I understand that, and they want a new direction.
I don't know.
I can bring them in that direction.
Did you catch Obama's policy speech the other day, which was basically sounded like New Deal 2.0?
Yeah, I did.
Had $24 billion.
I think that is very much exactly what the nation needs.
Yeah, well, we don't need tax breaks for Exxon, for the love of God.
And the idea of, okay, infrastructure is hurting. Look, instant way to inject, make those projects happen, employ people. Money moves into the economy from the bottom up. I think it's a no-brainer. It's the only thing that can be done that could actually work, I think.
I think you're right.
There's a lot of stuff that was put out there, so let me try to address it. First of all, in terms of standing up to the leaders of my party, the first major bill that I voted on in the Senate was in support of tort reform, which wasn't very popular with trial lawyers, a major constituency in the Democratic Party. I support charter schools and pay for performance for teachers. Doesn't make me popular with the teachers union. I support clean coal technology. Doesn't make me popular with environmentalists. So I've got a history of reaching across the aisle now.
You bet your ass.
With respect to a couple of things Senator McCain said, the notion that I voted for a tax increase for people making $42,000 a year has been disputed by everybody who's looked at this claim that Senator McCain keeps on making. Even Fox News disputes it. And that doesn't happen very often when it comes to accusations about me. So the fact of the matter is that if I occasionally mistaken your policies for George Bush's policies, it's because on the core economic issues that matter to the American people, on tax policy, on energy policy, on spending priorities, you have been a vigorous supporter of President Bush. Now, you've shown independence, commendable independence, on some key issues like torture, for example, and I give you enormous credit for that. But when it comes to economic policies,
Come on, land the jab.
Of the same thing, and it hasn't worked. And I think the American people understand it hasn't worked. We need to move in a new direction.
All right.
Let me just say,
about 30 seconds.
But it's very clear that I have disagreed with the Bush administration. I have
stop licking the blade and stick
party.
It in.
I got the scars to prove it. Whether it be bringing climate change to the floor of the Senate for the first time, whether it be opposition to spending and earmarks, whether it be the issue of torture, whether it be the conduct of the war in Iraq, which I vigorously oppose, whether it be on fighting the pharmaceutical companies, on Medicare prescription drugs, importation, whether it be fighting for an HMO patient's bill of rights, whether it be the establishment of the 9/11 Commission. I have a long record of reform and fighting through on the floor of the United States Senate.
All right.
Senator Obama, your argument for standing up to the leaders of your party isn't very convincing.
All right. We're going to move to another question. And the topic is leadership in this campaign. Both of you pledged to take the high road in this campaign, yet it has turned very nasty. Senator Obama, your campaign has used words like erratic, out of touch, lie, angry, losing his bearings to describe Senator McCain. Senator McCain, your commercials have included words like disrespectful, dangerous, dishonorable. He lied. Your running mate said he palled around with terrorists. Are each of you tonight willing to sit at this table and say to each other's face what your campaigns and the people in your campaigns have said about each other? And Senator McCain, you're first.
Well, this has been a tough campaign. It's been a very tough campaign. And I know from my experience in many campaigns that if Senator Obama had responded to my urgent request to sit down and do town hall meetings and come before the American people.
Oh, it's Obama's fault that that McCain's freakish little followers are out there inciting riots.
Anytime.
Of course.
The way Barry Goldwater and Jack Kennedy agreed to do before the intervention of the tragedy at Dallas. So I think the tone of this campaign could have been very different. And the fact is, it's gotten pretty tough. And I regret some of the negative aspects of both campaigns.
Oh, he regrets them. How sweet.
That it has taken
many
turns, which I think are unacceptable. One of them happened just the other day.
He hasn't said it out loud yet.
Respect. I've written about him. Congressman John Lewis, an American hero.
Oh, poor little John.
Oh, here we go.
And I was somehow associated with the worst chapter in American history.
No, he didn't say you were associated with it, you dumbass. He said you're behaving like it.
George Wallace.
And if you weren't careful, you were going to have a real problem on your hands.
Come on, slime George, John. You're going to lose Alabama, baby.
Out of bounds remark made by a Republican, no matter where they are, I have repudiated them. I hope that Senator Obama will repudiate those remarks that were made by Congressman John Lewis. Very unfair and totally inappropriate. So I want to tell you, we will run a truthful campaign. This is a tough campaign, and it's a matter of fact.
Big difference
Senator
between
Obama
truthful and factual, isn't there, John?
On negative ads
in
any political campaign
in
history.
I'm just waiting to see what Obama does.
And Senator Obama, when he said, and he signed a piece of paper that said he would take public financing for his campaign if I did, that was back when he was a long shot candidate, you didn't keep your word. And we looked into the camera and debate with Senator Clinton.
Damn it,
said,
all the hell, he just called you a liar. You better put that left hook across him.
Before I make a decision, you didn't tell the American people the truth. Because you didn't. And that's an unfortunate part.
Twice.
Now we have the highest spending by Senator Obama's campaign.
But Obama's just looking straight in the eye.
Watergate.
All right.
Well, look.
Here we go.
You know, I think that we expect presidential campaigns to be tough. I think that if you look at the record and the impressions of the American people, Bob, your network just did a poll showing that two-thirds of the American people think that Senator McCain's running a negative campaign versus one-third of mine. And 100%, John, of your ads, 100% of them have been negative.
Wow.
100, it absolutely is true.
That's three.
And now, I think the American people are less interested in our hurt feelings during the course of the campaign than addressing the issues that matter to them so deeply. And there is nothing wrong with us having a vigorous debate like we're having tonight about health care, about energy policy, about tax policy. That's the stuff that campaigns should be made of. The notion, though, that because we're not doing town hall meetings, that justifies some of the ads that have been going up, not just from your own campaign directly, John, but 527s and other organizations that make some pretty tough accusations. Well, I don't mind being attacked for the next 3 weeks. What the American people can't afford, though, is four more years of failed economic policies. And what they deserve over the next 4 weeks is that we talk about what's most pressing to them, the economic crisis. Senator McCain's own campaign said publicly last week that if we keep on talking about the economic crisis, we lose. So we need to change the subject.
Ouch.
And I would love to see the next 3 weeks devoted to talking about the economy, devoted to talking about health care, devoted to talking about energy, and figuring out how the American people can send their kids to college. That is something that I would welcome. But it requires, I think, a recognition that politics as usual has been practiced over the last several years is not solving the big problems here in America.
Well, if you'll turn on the television, as I watched the Arizona Cardinals defeat the Dallas Cowboys on Sunday.
Congratulations.
Every other ad was an attack ad on my health care plan. And any objection.
That's not an attack ad.
Said, it's not true. You're running ads right now.
That's a policy ad.
That I oppose federal funding for stem cell research. I don't. You're running ads that misportray completely my position on immigration. So the fact is,
what is your position on immigration, John? You've had several.
Yeah, are we talking about the one before you started running for president, or the one that you have now?
Lots of money in negative attack ads on me. And of course I've been talking about it, the economy. Of course I've talked
victim
to people
like Joe
Trump and tell him that I'm not going to spread his wealth around. I'm going to let him keep his wealth. And of course we're talking about a positive plan of action to restore this economy and restore jobs in America. That's what my campaign is all about, and that's what it'll continue to be all about. But, again, I did not hear a repudiation of Congressman Lewis.
Well, I mean, if we want to talk about Congressman Lewis, who is an American hero, he unprompted by my campaign, without my campaign's awareness, made a statement that he was troubled with what he was hearing at some of the rallies that your running mate was holding, in which all the public reports indicated were shouting, when my name came up, things like terrorist, and kill him, and that your running mate didn't mention, didn't stop, didn't say, hold on a second, that's kind of out of line. And I think Congressman Lewis's point was that we have to be careful about how we deal with our supporters. Now,
you've got to read what he said.
Let me complete my response. I do think that he inappropriately drew a comparison between what was happening there and what had happened during the Civil Rights Movement. And we immediately put out a statement saying that we don't think that comparison is appropriate. And, in fact, afterwards, Congressman Lewis put out a similar statement saying that he had probably gone over the line. The important point here is, though, the American people have become so cynical about our politics because all they see is a tit-for-tat. And back and forth. And what they want is...
Well, I can see the American Family Association press release already.
That we face right
Obama
now.
Says tit.
And that's what I have been trying to focus on this entire campaign.
I cannot,
we can have serious differences about our health care policy, for example, John, because we do have a difference on health care policy.
We do, and I hope we talk about it.
Talking about it this evening.
All right. Sure.
But when people suggest that I pal around with terrorists, then we're not talking about issues.
Well,
what we're talking about...
Let me just say categorically, I'm proud of the people that come to our rallies. Whenever you get a large rally of 10, 15, 20,000 people, you're going to have some fringe peoples. You know that. And we've always said that that's not...
That's the problem. His rally's made up of fringe people.
That group of young women who said...
And 20,000 to him, he comes up with like 12.
Saying anything derogatory about you, but or anything, and those veterans.
You can't count.
Again, what Kid A from the chat room mentioned. What about the guy who introduced him in Wisconsin, and said, "Take it to him, hit him, Senator, hit him."
Rallies or
yeah. No kidding.
Patriotic.
It's getting juicier though.
That wasn't some fringe guy. That was an invited presence to introduce him.
Someone yelled something at a rally. There's a lot of things that
cop in uniform, that guy should just be off the force.
In fact, some T-shirts that are very
unacceptable.
So the point is that I have repudiated every time someone's been out of line, whether they've been part of my campaign or not.
Oh, you damn stinking liar.
Do that. But the fact is
full of it.
That we need to absolutely not stand for the kind of things that have been going on. I haven't.
Well, Bob, as I said...
I mean, do you take issue with that?
You know, here's what I would say. I mean, we can have a debate back and forth about the merits of each other's campaigns. I suspect we won't agree here tonight. What I think is most important is that we recognize that to solve the key problems that we're facing, if we're going to solve two wars, the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, if we're going to focus on lifting wages that have declined over the last 8 years and create jobs here in America, then Democrats, independents, and Republicans, we're going to have to be able to work together. And what is important is making sure that we disagree without being disagreeable. And it means that we can have tough, vigorous debates around issues. What we can't do, I think, is try to characterize each other as bad people. That has been a culture in Washington, but that's been taking place for too long. And I think,
well, Bob,
John,
you asked me a direct question about it. Real quick. Mr. Harris, I don't care about an old washed-up terrorist, but as Senator Clinton said in her debates with you, we need to know the full extent of that relationship. We need to know the full extent of Senator Obama's relationship with Acorn, who is now...
He can smack both those down so easy.
...the greatest frauds in voter history in this country, maybe destroying a fabric of democracy. Same front outfit organization that your campaign gave $832,000 for quote, lighting and site selection. So all of these things need to be examined,
right.
Of course.
I'm going to let you respond.
I think it's going
to
be...
extend this.
It's going to be important to just... I'll respond to these two particular...
Oh, crap.
...respond to these two particular allegations that Senator McCain's made.
Lost the satellite for a second.
...gotten a lot of attention. In fact, Mr. Ayers has become the centerpiece of Senator McCain's campaign over the last 2 or 3 weeks. This has been their primary focus. So let's get the record straight. Bill Ayers is a professor of education in Chicago. Despicable acts with a radical domestic group. I have roundly condemned those acts. 10 years ago, he served, and I served, on a school reform board that was funded by one of Ronald Reagan's former ambassadors and close friends, Mr. Annenberg. Other members on that board were the presidents of the University of Illinois, the president of Northwestern University, who happens to be a Republican, the president of the Chicago Tribune, a Republican-leaning newspaper. Mr. Ayers is not involved in my campaign. He has never been involved in this campaign, and he will not advise me in the White House. So that's Mr. Ayers. Now, with respect to Acorn, Acorn is a community organization. Apparently what they've done is they were paying people to go out and register folks, and apparently some of the people who were out there didn't really register people. They just filled out a bunch of names. had nothing to do with us. We were not involved. The only involvement I've had with Acorn was I represented them alongside the U.S. Justice Department in making Illinois implement a motor voter law that helps people get registered at DMVs. Now, the reason I think that it's important to just get these facts out is because the allegation that Senator McCain's continually made is that somehow my associations are troubling. Let me tell you who I associate with. On economic policy, I associate with Warren Buffett and former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker. If I'm interested in figuring out my foreign policy, I associate myself with my running mate Joe Biden or with Dick Lugar, the Republican ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, or General Jim Jones, the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Those are the people, Democrats and Republicans, who have shaped my ideas and who will be surrounding me in the White House. And I think the fact that this has become such an important part of your campaign, Senator McCain, says more about your campaign than it says about me.
Well, again, while you were on the board of the Woods Foundation, you and Mr. Ayers together, you sent $230,000 to Acorn. So, and you launched your political campaign in Mr. Ayers' living room.
That's absolutely not
true. And the facts are facts, and records are records.
That's not the fact.
And it's not the fact. It's not the fact that Senator Obama chose to associate with a guy who, in 2001, said that he wished he'd bomb more, and he had a long association with him. It's the fact that all of the
all right, time to bring out Timmons
about Senator Obama's relationship with them and with Acorn, and the American people will make a judgment.
Well, I think we have like almost a whole glove off.
Back on track about creating jobs, about a brighter future for America, and that's what my campaign is about. And I'm not going to raise taxes the way Senator Obama wants to raise taxes in a tough economy. And that's really what this campaign is going to be about.
All right. Let's go to the next topic, and we may want to get back into some of this during this next discussion. I want to ask both of you about the people that you're going to bring into the government. And our best insight yet is who you picked as your running mates. So I'll begin by asking both of you this question.
Oh, you got to give it to Schieffer. He's doing pretty damn good, Bob.
Why would the country be better off if your running mate became president rather than his running mate?
Well, Joe Biden, I think, is one of the finest public servants that has served in this country. It's not just that he has some of the best foreign policy credentials of anybody, and Democrats and Republicans alike, I think, acknowledge his expertise there. But it's also that his entire life, he has never forgotten where he came from. Coming from Scranton, fighting on behalf of working families, remembering what it's like to see his father lose his job and go through a downward spiral economically. And as a consequence, his consistent pattern throughout his career is to fight for the little guy. That's what he's done when it comes to economic policies that will help working families get a leg up. That's what he's done when it comes to, for example, passing the landmark 1994 crime bill, the Violence Against Women's Act. Joe has always made sure that he is fighting on behalf of working families. And I think he shares my core values and my sense of where the country needs to go. Because after 8 years of failed policies, he and I both agree that what we're going to have to do is to reprioritize, make sure that we're investing in the American people, give tax cuts not to the wealthiest corporations, but give them to small businesses and give them to individuals who are struggling right now, make sure that we finally get serious about energy independence, something that has been languishing in Washington for 30 years, and make sure that our kids get a great education and can afford to go to college. So on the key issues that are of importance to American families, Joe Biden's already always been on the right side, and I think he will make an outstanding president if, heaven forbid, something happened to me.
Senator.
Well, Americans have gotten to know Sarah Palin. She's a role model to women.
Really?
And reformers all over America.
She's marrying her daughter off to a high school dropout, and that's a role model to women. Got it, John.
Of her own party when she ran for governor. When she was ahead of their Energy and Natural Resources Board, she saw corruption. She resigned. She said, this can't go on. She's given money.
It's not exactly how that played out.
She's cut the size of government. She negotiated.
She's got a great house built for herself.
Facing them down, a $40 billion pipeline of natural gas. That's
and she's married to a former secessionist.
Of the United States.
Hey, are you hearing that about Todd Palin could end up being a security problem? Like, he might not make clearance because of the AIP stuff?
Yeah.
Breath of fresh air coming.
I think it's a real concern. People have been blocked for less.
Network and the cronyism that's been so much a part of it that I've fought against for all these years. She'll be my partner. She understands reform. And by the way, she also understands special needs families.
And she's mavericky.
She understands that autism is on the rise. We got to find
why is it on the rise, John?
We've got to reach out to these families and help them.
Mercury,
them
John.
Need as they raise these very
from coal,
needs.
John.
She understands that better than almost
not you, John. That John.
I'm proud of her, and that she.
I got to figure out a way to pronounce the H.
People all over America have never been involved in the political process, and I can't tell you how proud I am of her and her family. Her husband's a pretty tough guy, by the way, too.
Do you think she's qualified to be president?
You know, I think that's going to be up to the American people. I think that obviously she's a
well done keeping a straight face
politician who's has, I think, excited a base in the Republican Party.
The mouth breathing knuckle draggers.
The work she's done on behalf of special
needs. She's the special needs running mate.
I do want to just point out that autism, for example, or other special needs will require some additional funding if we're going to get serious in terms of research. That is something that every
maybe
family
getting away from coal there, Barack. That might help with the autism problem.
And if we have a across-the-board spending freeze, we're not going to be able to do it. That's an example of, I think, the kind of the use of the scalpel that we want to make sure that we're funding some of those programs.
Do you think Senator Biden is qualified?
Well, I think that Joe Biden is qualified in many respects, but I do point out that he's been wrong on many foreign policy and national security issues, which is supposed to be his strength. He voted against the first Gulf War. He voted against it, and obviously we had to take Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, or it would have threatened the Middle Eastern world supply.
Or it would have threatened the Saudis. Come on, John. Lumpy, can't you be a little bit straight?
Countries. We're seeing Iraq united as Iraqis, tough, hard, but we're seeing them. We're now about to have an agreement for status of forces in Iraq coming up. There are several issues in which, frankly, Joe Biden and I openly and honestly disagreed on national security policy, and he's been wrong on a number of the major ones. But again, I want to come back to, you know, notice every time
because they disagreed, that made McCain right. Did I follow that logic?
Why do we always have to spend more? Why can't we have transparency, accountability, reform of these agencies of government? Maybe that's why he's asked for sought and proposed $860 billion worth of new spending and wants to raise people's taxes in a time of incredible challenge and difficulty and heartache for the American
Let's Lumpy.
Topic here. We're running a little behind. Let's talk about energy and climate control. Every president
and people look for the government to do when business isn't able to do what it's supposed to do. And we're in one of those times. So hence, people look to Democrats.
Yep.
Nixon said if we imported from 17% to 34% of our foreign oil, now we're importing more than 60%. Would each of you give us a number, a specific number of how much you believe we can reduce our foreign oil imports during your first term? And I believe the first question goes to you, Senator McCain.
I believe we can, and for all intents and purposes, eliminate our dependence on Middle Eastern oil and Venezuelan oil. Canadian oil is fine. By the way, when
yeah, it's not communist oil.
Unilaterally
like the
renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Canadians said, "Yeah, and we'll sell our oil to China." You don't tell countries you're going to unilaterally renegotiate agreements with them.
Remind me to talk about Venezuela after this is all over.
Yes, do let's.
Nuclear power plants right away. We can store and we can reprocess. Senator Obama will tell you, in the as the extreme environmentalists do, it has to be safe. Look, we've sailed
right, because nuclear plants don't have to be safe.
We process and spent nuclear fuel, Senator Obama, no problem. So the point is,
I'm a vegetarian to the extreme.
Wind, tide, solar, natural gas.
I eat extreme tofu.
Development of flex fuel, hybrid, clean coal technology. Clean coal technology
extra
is
firm.
Key in the heartland of America that's hurting rather badly.
Right.
So I think we can easily, within 7, 8, 10 years, if we put our minds to it, we can eliminate our dependence on the places in the world that harm our national security if we don't achieve our independence from
it. All right. Can we reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and by how much in the first term, in 4 years?
I think that in 10 years, we can reduce our dependence so that we no longer have to import oil from the Middle East or Venezuela. I think that's about a realistic time frame. And this is the most important issue that our future economy is going to face. Obviously, we've got an immediate crisis
looking
right now.
Looking down that camera
but
barrel.
Nothing's more important than us no longer borrowing $700 billion or more from China and sending it to Saudi Arabia. It's mortgaging our children's future. Now, from the start of this campaign, I've identified this as one of my top priorities, and here's what I think we have to do. Number one, we do need to expand domestic production. And that means, for example, telling the oil companies the 68 million acres that they currently have leased, that they're not drilling, use them or lose them. And I think that we should look at offshore drilling and implement it in a way that allows us to get some additional oil. But understand, we only have 3 to 4% of the world's oil reserves, and we use 25% of the world's oil, which means that we can't drill our way out of the problem. And that's why I focused on putting resources into solar, wind, biodiesel, geothermal. These have been priorities of mine since I got to the Senate, and it is absolutely critical that we develop a high fuel-efficient car that's built not in Japan and not in South Korea, but built here in the United States of America. We invented the auto industry, and the fact that we have fallen so far behind is something that we have to work on. Now, I just want to make one last point, because Senator McCain mentioned NAFTA and the issue of trade, and that actually bears on this issue. I believe in free trade, but I also believe that for far too long, certainly during the course of the Bush administration, with the support of Senator McCain, the attitude's been that any trade agreement is a good trade agreement. And NAFTA did not have enforceable labor agreements and environmental agreements. And what I said was we should include those and make them enforceable. In the same way that we should enforce rules against China manipulating its currency to make our exports more expensive and their exports to us cheaper. And when it comes to South Korea, we've got a trade agreement up right now. They are sending hundreds of thousands of South Korean cars into the United States. That's all good. We can only get 4,000 to 5,000 into South Korea. That is not free trade. We've got to have a president who's going to be advocating on behalf of American businesses and American workers, and I make no apology for that.
Senator.
Bang.
You know, I admire so much Senator Obama's eloquence, and you really have to pay attention to words. He said, we will look at offshore drilling. Do you get that? Look at. We can offshore drill now. We've got to do it now. We will reduce the cost of a barrel of oil because we show the world that we have a supply of our own. It's doable. The technology is there, and we have to drill now.
What?
Now, on the subject of free trade agreements, I am a free trader.
He's not here to Christmas
fruitcake.
We
need to
have honest to God,
education and training programs for displaced workers that work, going to our community colleges. But let me give you another example of free trade agreement that Senator Obama opposes. Right now, because of previous agreements, some made by President Clinton, the goods that, and products that we
designed
send
by Bush
to Colombia,
one,
which is our largest agricultural importer of our products, there's $1 billion that our businesses have paid so far in order to get our goods in there. Because of previous agreements, their goods and products come into our country for free. So Senator Obama, who has never traveled south of our border, opposes
as opposed to him,
trade,
who was born south of it,
that's helping us try to stop the flow of drugs into our country that's killing young Americans. And also, the country that just freed three Americans that will help us create jobs.
Gene sent me an interesting story. The Mexicans have completely had it with the American drug war and are very likely now pushing legislation to decriminalize small amounts to just try and stop the death because of the American side of the drug war.
Yep.
But maybe you ought to travel down there and visit them, and maybe you could understand it a lot better.
Let me respond. Actually, I understand it pretty well. The history in Colombia right now is that labor leaders have been targeted for assassination.
Oh.
On a fairly consistent basis, and there have not been prosecutions. And what I have said, because the free trade, the trade agreement itself does have labor and environmental protections, but we have to stand for human rights, and we have to make sure that violence isn't being perpetrated against workers who are just trying to organize for their rights, which is why, for example, I supported the Peruvian Free Trade Agreement, which was a well-structured agreement. I think that the important point is we've got to have a president who understands the benefits of free trade, but also is going to enforce unfair trade agreements and is going to stand up to other countries. And the last point I'll make, because we started on energy, when I talked about the automakers, they are obviously getting hammered right now. They were already having a tough time because of high gas prices. And now, with the financial crisis, car dealerships are closing and people can't get car loans. That's why I think it's important for us to get loan guarantees to the automakers, but we do have to hold them responsible as well to start producing the highly fuel-efficient cars of the future. And Detroit had dragged its feet too long in terms of getting that done. It's going to be one of my highest priorities because transportation accounts for about 30% of our total energy consumption. If we can get that right, then we can move in a direction not only of...
Well, listen, substance.
But we can create 5 million new jobs all across America.
The assassinations thing just completely hit me from left field. I never thought I would have ever heard that in a debate.
And also to make wind turbines and solar panels, the kinds
of... He gets
of,
a lot of stuff right.
...clean energy approaches that should be the driver of our economy for the next century.
Well, let me just say that this is, Senator Obama doesn't want a free trade agreement with our best ally.
Lumpy, talk about what you want.
He wants to sit down across the table without precondition with Hugo Chavez, the guy who has been helping FARC, the terrorist organization. Free
helping
trade
FARC.
Between ourselves and Colombia. I just recited to you the benefits of concluding that agreement. $1 billion of American dollars that could have gone to creating jobs and businesses in the United States, opening up those markets.
Yeah, and who cares if a few labor leaders get two in the chest and one in the head?
Wants to
restrict
trade, and he wants to raise taxes. And the last president of the United States that tried that was Herbert Hoover. And we went from a deep recession into a depression.
And Herbert Hoover was a...
When I'm president of the United States.
Everybody.
Let's go to a new topic.
Repiglicking?
Given the current
economic situation... You might be right, Rabbit. You might be right.
Would either favor controlling health care costs over expanding health care coverage? The question is first, Senator Grobaugh.
We've got to do both. And that's exactly what my plan does. Look, as I travel around the country, this is the issue that... will break your heart over and over again. Yesterday, I was in Toledo shaking some hands in the line. Two women, both of them probably in their mid to late 50s, had just been laid off of their plant. Neither of them have health insurance. And they were desperate for some way of getting coverage because, understandably, they're worried that if they get sick, they could go bankrupt. So,
or die.
Here's what my plan does. If you have health insurance, then you don't have to do anything. If you've got health insurance through your employer, you can keep your health insurance, keep your choice of doctor, keep your plan. The only thing we're going to try to do is lower costs so that those cost savings are passed on to you. And we estimate we can cut average family's premium by about $2,500 per year. If you don't have health insurance, then what we're going to do is to provide you the option of buying into the same kind of federal pool that both Senator McCain and I enjoy as federal employees, which will give you high-quality care, choice of doctors, at lower cost because so many people are part of this insured group. We're going to make sure that insurance companies can't discriminate on the basis of pre-existing conditions. We'll negotiate with the drug companies for the cheapest available price on drugs. We are going to invest in information technology to eliminate bureaucracy and make the system more efficient. And we are going to make sure that we manage chronic illnesses like diabetes and heart disease that cost a huge amount but could be prevented. We've got to put more money into preventive care. This will cost some money on the front end, but over the long term, this is the only way that not only are we going to make families healthy, but it's also how we're going to save the federal budget because we can't afford these escalating costs.
All right, Senator McCain.
Well, it is a terribly painful situation for Americans. They're seeing their premiums, their co-pays.
Yeah, because it ain't for him because he's got socialized health care, 13 houses and 15 cars.
I was going to say, there's pain out there, but it's someone else's pain. Next subject.
That are inflicting such pain on working families and people across this country. And I am convinced we need to do a lot of things. We need to put health care records online. The VA does that.
Yeah, because that'll fix it.
We need to have more community health centers. We need to have walk-in clinics.
The rise of Bob, every time he mentions that, I just keep wanting to ask the question. Okay, which one of his mates runs the tech company that could supply that service?
Maybe none of them yet. Maybe Neil Bush is putting that company together even as we speak in between, you know, tie hookers.
There you go.
I want to give every American family a $5,000 refundable tax credit. Take it and get anywhere in America the health care that you wish. Now, my old buddy Joe, the plumber's out there. Now, Joe, Senator Obama's plan, if you're a small business and you're able, and you're the guy that sells to you will not have a capital gains tax increase, which Senator Obama wants, if you're out there, my friend, and you've got employees and you've got kids, if you don't adopt the health care plan that Senator Obama mandates, he's going to fine you. Now, Senator Obama, I'd still like to know what that fine's going to be. And I don't think that Joe right now wants to pay a fine when he is seeing such difficult times in America's economy. Senator Obama wants to set up health care bureaucracies, take over the health care.
You know, I've got lumpy on the video here, a little bit delayed from what I'm hearing.
Object is a single.
But honest to God, he's made a couple of faces that made him look like Uncle Fester.
You love Canada and England.
Oh, Bob, there's been a couple of times where he really looked like, you know, his eyes were either going to pop out of his head, he was going to break wind, or he was going
to
explode.
I'm happy to talk to you, Joe, too, if you're out there. Here's your fine, zero. You won't pay
zero?
A fine because, zero, because as I said in our last debate, and I'll repeat, John, I exempt small businesses from the requirement for large businesses that can afford to provide health care to their employees but are not doing it. I exempt small businesses from having to pay into a kitty. But large businesses that can afford it, we've got a choice. Either they provide health insurance to their employees, or somebody has to. Right now what happens is those employees get dumped into either the Medicaid system, which taxpayers pick up, or they're going to the emergency room for uncompensated care, which everybody picks up in their premiums. The average family is paying an additional $900 a year in higher premiums because of the uninsured. So here's what we do. We exempt small businesses. In fact, what Joe, if you want to do the right thing with your employees and you want to provide them health insurance, we'll give you a 50% credit so that you will actually be able to afford it. If you don't have health insurance or you want to buy into a group plan, you will be able to buy into the plan that I just described. Now, what we haven't talked about is Senator McCain's plan. He says he's going to give you all a $5,000 tax credit. That sounds pretty good. And you can go out and buy your own insurance. Here's the problem. That for about 20 million people, you may find yourself no longer having employer-based health insurance. This is because younger people might be able to get health insurance for $5,000, young and healthy folks. Older folks, less healthy folks, what's going to end up happening is that you're going to be the only ones left in your employer-based system. Your employers won't be able to afford it. And once you're out on your own with this $5,000 credit, Senator McCain, for the first time, is going to be taxing the health care benefits that you have from your employer. And this is your plan, John. For the first time in history, you will be taxing people's health care benefits. By the way, the average policy costs about $12,000. So if you got $5,000 and it's going to cost you $12,000, that's a loss for you. Last point about Senator McCain's plan is that insurers right now, the main restrictions on what they do is primarily state law. And under Senator McCain's plan, those rules would be stripped away, and you would start seeing a lot more insurance companies cherry-picking and excluding people from coverage. That, I think, is a mistake, and you know, I think that this is a fundamental difference in our campaign and how we would approach health care.
What about that?
Hey, Joe, you're rich. Congratulations. Because what Joe wanted to do was buy the business that he's been working for 10, 12 hours a day, 7 days a
week. Might be kind of nice if they could mention that Joe actually does make more than
$250,000. In other words, take Joe's money and then you decide what to do with it. Now, Joe, you're rich. Congratulations. And you will then fall into the category where you'll have to pay a fine if you don't provide health insurance that Senator Obama mandates, not the kind that you think is best for your family, your children, your employees, but the kind that he mandates for you. That's big government at its best. Now, 95% of the people in America will receive more money under my plan because they will receive not only their present benefits, which may be taxed, which will
more be money, taxed, but not better health care.
Well, there's that.
Except for those people that have the gold-plated Cadillac insurance policies that have to do with cosmetic
like
surgery
yours.
And transplants and all of those kinds of things. And the good thing
what a hypocritical just
bastard.
He's really fallen over.
Plan in America today is $5,800. I'm going to give them $5,000 to take with them wherever they want to go. And this will give them affordability. This will give them availability.
Where's that $5,000 going to come from, Lumpy?
To choose their own.
And his own relos are just going, we don't know who this guy is.
For them. This really gets down to the fundamental difference in our philosophies. If you notice that in all of his proposals, Senator Obama wants government to do the job. Senator Obama wants government to do the
that
job.
One.
I want, Joe, you to do the job. I want to leave money in your pocket. I want you to be able to choose the health care for you and your family. That's what I'm all about. And we've had too much government and too much spending. And the government is...
Really, Lumpy, did we have too much government when the bodies were floating face down in the lower Ninth Ward? Was that too much government there, Lumpy?
With Democrats and
I want to just sit back and do... SFA and let you sink and not actually try and do anything to, again, as I say, have the government come in where the market has failed.
Now, under Senator McCain's plan, there is a strong risk that people...
Gail and I were talking. I really got the impression, and maybe it started with Rudd, that the era of Reagan and Thatcher is finally being rejected, Bob. Did you hear about Kevin Rudd's statements yesterday about unrestrained capitalism?
No.
We'll do it after.
Okie doke.
That includes you, Joe. Right.
Let's stop there and go to another question. And this one goes to Senator McCain. Senator McCain, you believe Roe v. Wade should be overturned. Senator Obama, you believe it shouldn't. Could either of you ever nominate someone to the Supreme Court who disagrees with you on this issue, Senator McCain?
I would never, and have never in all the years I've been there, impose a litmus test on any nominee.
Ah, you damn dirty, stinking liar. That's another one.
I thought it was a bad decision. I think there was a lot of decisions. I think that the decision should rest in the hands of the states. I'm a Federalist. And I believe strongly that we should have nominees to the United States Supreme Court based on their qualifications. Rather than
what he meant was he's a states' writer. That's not a Federalist.
Say that there was a time a few years ago when the United States Senate was about to blow up.
Like George Wallace was a states' writer, but never mind.
Confirm a judge, and the Democrats were blocking in an unprecedented fashion. We got together, seven Republicans, seven Democrats. You were offered a chance to join. You chose not to because you were afraid of the appointment of, quote, conservative judges. I voted for Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg, not because I agreed with their ideology, but because I thought they were qualified and that judge and that elections have consequences when presidents are nominated. This is a very important issue we're talking about. Senator Obama voted against Justice Breyer and Justice Roberts on the grounds that they didn't meet ideological standards. That's not the way we should judge these nominees. Elections have consequences. They should be judged on their qualifications. And so that's what I will do. I will find the best people in the world, in the United States of America, who have a history of strict adherence to the Constitution and
but
not
even if it was
legislating
someone,
from the bench.
Even someone who had a history of being for abortion rights, you would consider them?
I would consider anyone in their qualifications. I do not believe that someone who has supported Roe v. Wade that would be a part of those qualifications. But I certainly would not impose any litmus test.
All right.
Well, I think it's true that we shouldn't apply a strict litmus test. And the most important thing in any judge is their capacity to provide fairness and justice to the American people. And it is true that this is going to be, I think, one of the most consequential decisions of the next president. It is very likely that one of us will be making at least one and probably more than one appointments, and Roe versus Wade probably hangs in the balance. Now, I would not provide a litmus test, but I am somebody who believes that Roe versus Wade was rightly decided. I think that abortion is a very difficult issue, and it is a moral issue, and one that I think good people on both sides.
It's a biological issue, guys.
What ultimately I believe is that women, in consultation with their families, their doctors, their religious advisors, are in the best position to make this decision. And I think that the Constitution has a right to privacy in it that shouldn't be subject to state referendum any more than our First Amendment rights are subject to state referendum, any more than many of the other rights that we have should be subject to popular vote. So this is going to be an important issue. I will look for those judges who have an outstanding judicial record, who have the intellect, and who hopefully have a sense of what real world folks are going through. I'll just give you one quick example. Senator McCain and I disagreed recently when the Supreme Court made it more difficult for a woman named Lily Ledbetter to press her claim for pay discrimination. For years, she had been getting paid less than a man had been paid for doing the exact same job. And when she brought a suit saying equal pay for equal work, the judges said, well, it's taken you too long to bring this lawsuit, even though she didn't know about it until fairly recently. We tried to overturn it in the Senate. I supported that effort to provide better guidance to the courts. John McCain opposed it. I think that it's important for judges to understand that if a woman is out there trying to raise a family, trying to support her family, and is being treated unfairly, then the court has to stand up if nobody else will. And that's the kind of judge that I want.
Time's up.
Obviously, that law waived this statute of limitations, which you could have gone back 20 or 30 years. It was a tri-lawyer's dream. Let me talk to you about an important aspect of this issue. We have to change the culture of America. Those of us who are proudly pro-life understand that. And it's got to be courage and compassion that we show to a young woman who's facing this terribly difficult decision. Senator Obama is a member of the...
Courage, compassion, and authoritarianism, of course.
...voted in the Judiciary Committee against a law that would provide immediate medical attention to a child born as a failed abortion. He voted against that. And then on the floor of the state Senate, as he did 130 times as a state senator, he voted present. Then there was another bill before the Senate Judiciary Committee in the state of Illinois, not that long ago, where he voted against a ban on partial birth abortion.
A procedure which doesn't exist.
That one drives me just insane.
Terrible. And then on the floor of the Illinois State Senate, he voted present. I don't know how you vote present on some of that. I don't know how you align yourself with the extreme aspect of the pro-abortion movement in America. And that's his record. And that's a matter of his record. And he'll say it has something to do with Roe v. Wade, about the Illinois State Senate. There was clear-cut votes.
Oh, so now he's even answering. Wow.
Direct contradiction.
He's magic.
Views of mainstream America.
Response?
Let me respond to this. If it sounds incredible that I would vote to withhold life-saving treatment from an infant, that's because it's not true. Here are the facts. There was a bill that was put forward before the Illinois Senate that said you have to provide life savings treatment, and that would have helped to undermine Roe versus Wade. The fact is that there was already a law on the books in Illinois that required providing life saving treatment, which is why not only myself, but pro-choice Republicans and Democrats voted against it, and the Illinois Medical Society, the organization of doctors in Illinois, voted against it. Their Hippocratic Oath would have required them to provide care, and there was already a law in the books. With respect to partial birth abortion, I am completely supportive of a ban on late-term abortions, partial birth or otherwise, as long as there's an exception for the mother's health and life. And this did not contain that exception, and I attempted, as many have in the past, of including that so that it is constitutional. And that was rejected, and that's why I voted present, because I'm willing to support a ban on late-term abortions as long as we have that exception. Last point I want to make on the issue of abortion. This is an issue that, look, it divides us. And in some ways it may be difficult to reconcile the two views. But there surely is some common ground when both those who believe in choice and those who are opposed to abortion can come together and say we should try to prevent unintended pregnancies by providing appropriate education to our youth.
Sorry.
Indicating that sexuality is
just say no, like Bristol.
Not be engaged in cavalier activities.
Choice and by shotgun.
Options for adoption and helping single mothers.
Well, I mean, you know, shotgun or rifle, that's a choice.
Baby. Those are all things that we put in the Democratic platform for the first time this year, and I think that's where we can find some common ground, because nobody's pro-abortion. I think it's always a tragic situation. We should try to reduce these circumstances.
Let's give Senator McCain
just
a short
again,
response.
Again, example of the eloquence of Senator Obama. He's health for the mother.
Oh, because eloquence is bad. That's he's telegraphing to the morons.
Almost anything.
He's being elitist.
That's the extreme pro-abortion.
Yeah, you know, intelligent.
Health. But look, Cindy and I are adopted parents. We know what a treasure and joy it is to have an adopted child in our lives. We'll do everything we can to approve.
Then why didn't you adopt a little American child there, Lumpy? There's plenty of them. There's foster children who are 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old who ache for a stable home. But, Lumpy, they weren't right now, were they?
Help these young women who are facing such a difficult
time. God, he makes me sick.
Compassion. It will help them with the adoptive services, but the courage to bring that child into this world, and we'll help take care of it.
Let's stop there, because I want to get in a question on education, and I'm afraid this is going to have to be our last question, gentlemen. The question is this: the U.S. spends more per capita than any other country on education, yet by every international measurement in math and science competence from kindergarten through the 12th grade, we trail most of the countries of the world. The implications.
That's because we're right-wing, mouth-breathing,
knuckle-draggers. Threat to our national security.
Do everything in their power to keep us from teaching science.
What do you intend to do about it? The question to Senator Obama first.
This probably has more to do with our economic future than anything. And that means it also has a national security implication, because there's never been a nation on Earth that saw its economy decline and continued to maintain its primacy as a military power. So we've got to get our education system right. Now, typically what's happened is that there's been a debate between more money or reform. And I think we need both. In some cases, we are going to have to invest. Early childhood education, which closes the achievement gap so that every child is prepared for school. Every dollar we invest in that, we end up getting huge benefits with improved reading scores, reduced dropout rates, reduced delinquency rates. I think it's going to be critically important for us to recruit a generation of new teachers, an army of new teachers, especially in math and science. give them higher pay, give them more professional development and support in exchange for higher standards and accountability. And I think it's important for us to make college affordable. Right now, I meet young people all across the country who either have decided not to go to college, or if they're going to college, they are taking on $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, $60,000 worth of debt. And it's very difficult for them to go into some fields, like basic research and science, for example, thinking to themselves that they're going to have a mortgage before they even buy a house. And that's why I've proposed a $4,000 tuition credit every student, every year, in exchange for some form of community service, whether it's military service, whether it's Peace Corps, whether it's working in a community. If we do those things, then I believe that we can create a better school system. But there's one last ingredient that I just want to mention, and that's parents. We can't do it just in the schools. Parents are going to have to show more responsibility. They've got to turn off the TV set, put away the video games, and finally start instilling that thirst for knowledge that our students need.
Senator McCain.
Well, it's a civil rights issue of the 21st century. There's no doubt that we have achieved equal access to schools in America after a long and difficult
struggle.
What is the advantage in a low-income area of sending a child to a failed school, and that being your only choice? So choice and competition amongst schools is one of the key elements that's already been proven in places like New Orleans.
I think Spike's about to win
a
toaster.
And other places where we have charter schools, where we take good teachers and we reward them and promote them, and we find bad teachers another line of work. And we have to be able to give parents the same choice, frankly, that Senator Obama and Mrs. Obama had and Cindy and I had, to send our kids to the school, their kids to the school of their choice. Charter schools aren't the only answer, but they're providing competition. They are providing the kind of competitions that have upgraded both schools, types of schools. Now, throwing money at the problem is not the answer. You will find that some of the worst school systems in America get the most money per student.
BS. So
I believe that we need to reward these good teachers. We need to encourage programs such as Teach for America and Troops to Teachers, where people, after having served in the military, can go right to teaching and not have to take these examinations which or have the certification.
Let's not just make sure that they're, you know, appropriate for teaching before we send them out there.
Improve education in this.
Yeah, what's four times three? Yeah, you, Haji, tell me.
We need to make those student loans.
Well, and, you know, that's an extension of his, you know, I was a POW, you know, don't question my ability to do anything. Because
yeah,
because
he hasn't done enough brown nosing of the military tonight by any stretch of the imagination.
You know, I'm all for the idea of offering some sort of vehicle to put them into education, but, you know, make sure they got the tools to do it.
Well, we have a tradition.
The military sure doesn't teach that kind of stuff. I mean, come on.
No.
And that's a tradition that has served us well. But I do think that it is important for the federal government to step up and help local school districts do some of the things they need to do. Now, we tried to do this under President Bush. He put forward No Child Left Behind. Unfortunately, they left the money behind for No Child Left Behind. And local school districts end up having more of a burden, a bunch of unfunded mandates, the same kind of thing that happened with special education, where we did the right thing by saying every school should provide education to kids with special needs, but we never followed through on the promise of funding, and that left local school districts very cash-strapped. So what I want to do is focus on early childhood education, providing teachers higher salaries in exchange for more support. Senator McCain and I actually agree on two things that he just mentioned, charter schools. I doubled the number of charter schools in Illinois, despite some reservations from teachers' unions. I think it is important for us to foster competition inside the public schools. And we also agree on the need for making sure that if we have bad teachers, that they are swiftly, after given an opportunity to prove themselves, if they can't hack it, then we need to move on because our kids have to have their best future. Where we disagree is on the idea that we can somehow give our vouchers, give vouchers as a way of securing the problems in our education system. And I also have to disagree on Senator McCain's record when it comes to college accessibility and affordability. I mean, recently his key economic advisor was asked about why he didn't seem to have some specific programs to help young people go to college. And the response was, well, you know, we can't give money to every interest group that comes along. I don't think America's youth are interest groups. I think they're our future. And this is an example of where we are going to have to prioritize. We can't say we're going to do things and then not explain in concrete terms how we're going to pay for it. And if we're going to do some of the things you mentioned, like lowering loan rates or what have you, somebody's got to pay for it. It's not going to happen on its own.
What about that, Senator?
Well, sure. I'm sure you are aware, Senator Obama, of the program in the Washington, D.C. school system where vouchers are provided, and there's a certain number, I think it's 1,000 and some 9,000 parents asked to be eligible for that because they wanted to have the same choice that you and I and Cindy and your wife have had. And that is because they wanted to choose the school that they thought was best for their children. And we all know the state of the Washington, D.C. school system. That was vouchers. That was vouchers, Senator Obama, and I'm frankly surprised you didn't pay more attention to that example. Now, as far as the No Child Left Behind is concerned, it was a great first beginning, in my view. It had its flaws. It had its problems. The first time we had looked at the issue of education in America from
saying No Child Behind left had flaws is like saying the Titanic had a pinhole.
And reauthorize it.
And to our Duke in the chat room, yes, I'll oblige. Yes, the toaster does go to Spike.
Great program.
We heard vouchers.
A lot of people, including me, said, look, it's not doing what it should do. By the third grade, many times children who are in Head Start program aren't any better off than the others. Let's reform it. Let's reform it and fund it. That was, of course, out of bounds by the Democrats. We need to reform these programs. We need to have transparency. We need to have rewards. It's a system that cries out for accountability and transparency and the adequate funding. And I just said to you earlier, town hall meeting after town hall meeting, parents come with kids, children, precious children.
Knuckle draggers, mouth breathers, wing nuts.
Knows about that better than most. And we'll find, and we'll spend the money, research, to find the cause of autism. And we'll care for these young children. And all Americans.
Not going to have to look very hard, John. It's mercury from coal.
But to have a situation, as you mentioned in our earlier comments, that the most expensive education in the world is in the United States of America.
There's a bit of emotion going on here.
Cries out for reform as well.
Hasn't quite torn open, but
reforms, and I will fund the ones that are reformed. But I'm not
going
to continue.
They're going at each other.
Money at a problem.
At least.
And I've got to tell you that vouchers, where they are requested and where they are agreed to, are a good and workable system, and it's been proven.
I'll just make a quick comment about vouchers in D.C. Senator McCain's absolutely right. The D.C. school system is in terrible shape, and it has been for a very long time. We've got a wonderful new superintendent there who's working very hard with the young mayor there to try actually supports charters.
She supports vouchers.
But here's the thing, is that even if Senator McCain were to say that vouchers were the way to go, I disagree with him on this because the data doesn't show that it actually solves the problem. The centerpiece of Senator McCain's education policy is to increase the voucher program in D.C. by 2,000 slots. That leaves all of you who live in the other 50 states without an education reform policy from Senator McCain. So if we are going to be serious about this issue, we've got to have a president who is going to tackle it head on, and that's what I intend to do as president.
All right.
Because there's not enough vouchers, therefore we shouldn't do it, even though it's working. I got it.
All right. Gentlemen, we have come to the close.
He's a snarky little
both of you
bastard
closing statements tonight. I'd like to invite our viewers.
Yeah. Interesting. What do you reckon, Bob?
Well, is it's closing statement time?
Oh, sorry. Did I go early?
Senator McCain.
Sorry.
Well, thank you again, Bob, and thanks to Hofstra, and it's great to be with you again. I think we've
Hello,
had a very
Cleveland.
Healthy discussion. My friends, as I said in my opening remarks, these are very difficult times and challenges for America, and they were graphically demonstrated again today. America needs a new direction. We cannot be satisfied with what we've been doing.
Well, that lets you out then, Lumpy.
I have a record of reform and taking on my party, the other party, the special interests, whether it be HMO patients' bill of rights or trying to clean up the campaign finance system in this country, or whether it be establishment of a 9/11 commission. I have a long record of it. I've been a careful steward of your tax dollars. We have to make health care affordable and available. We have to make a quality education there for all of our citizens, not just a privileged few. We have to stop the spending. We have to stop the spending, which has mortgaged your children's futures. All of these things and all the promises and commitments that Senator Obama and I made to you tonight will be based on whether you can trust us or not, to be careful stewards of your tax dollar, to make sure America is safe and secure and prosperous, to make sure we reform the institutions of government. That's why I've asked you to not only to examine my record, but my proposals for the future of this country. I've spent my entire life in the service of this nation and putting my country first.
And did you know he was a POW?
That has served our country for a long time in war and in peace. It's been the great honor of my life. And I've been proud to serve, and I hope you'll give me an opportunity to serve again.
For at least a couple of years before I keel over and turn it over to Mussolini.
Well, I want to thank Senator McCain and Bob for moderating. I think we all know America's going through tough times right now. The policies of the last 8 years and Washington's unwillingness to tackle the tough problems for decades has left us in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. And that's why the biggest risk we could take right now is to adopt the same failed policies and the same failed politics that we've seen over the last 8 years and somehow expect a different result. We need fundamental change in this country, and that's what I'd like to bring. You know, over the last 20 months, you've invited me into your homes, you've shared your stories with me, and you've confirmed once again the fundamental decency and generosity of the American people. And that's why I'm sure that our brighter days are still ahead. But we're going to have to invest in the American people again, in tax cuts for the middle class, in health care for all Americans and college for every young person who wants to go, in businesses that can create the new energy economy of the future, in policies that will lift wages and will grow our middle class. These are the policies I've fought for my entire career. And these are the policies I want to bring to the White House. But it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be quick. It's going to be requiring all of us, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, to come together and to renew a spirit of sacrifice and service and responsibility. I'm absolutely convinced we can do it. I would ask for your vote. And I promise you that if you give me the extraordinary honor of serving as your president, I will work every single day tirelessly on your behalf and on the behalf of the future of our children. Thank you very much.
Senator Obama, Senator McCain, thank you very much. This concludes the final debate. I'm Bob Schieffer of CBS News, and I will leave you tonight with what my mother always said. Go vote now. It'll make you feel big and strong. Good night, everyone.
Okay, are we going to get to see whether or not they shake hands and make nicey and stuff like that, do you reckon, John?
Well, on mine, they're already cutting to the ABC studio because they'll go back to, like, kids programming.
I'm a little bit delayed, but I've got the C-SPAN video feed up here.
Right.
You know, I'm amazed, John, and, okay, there's the handshake. There's the pat on the back. I'm really excited. I don't know why I wouldn't have assumed it, but the fact that the ABC down there breaks in carries this programming.
Yeah, and so is SBS. So I've actually just flipped over and I can see both couples on stage now, and you know, I was amazed that it got as kind of a little bit warm as it did. I thought Obama kind of caught the mud and, you know, kind of threw it back pretty well. Because, you know, the Ayers thing and the Acorn thing are completely clearable. And, you know, it only takes 30 seconds to clarify each one and end of story, really.
And he did it. And what I think he, what they're going for, and this is a radically different approach, perhaps, but I think what Obama is going for, John, is the appearance of coolness and unflappability. You know, Reverbo sent me a picture of a magazine cover a couple of nights ago, and he just said, "Is this the coolest looking guy you've ever seen?" And it was a picture of Obama getting out of a car, you know, with his glasses on, and it just, yeah, it looked. And I don't mean cool like in, you know, cool daddy-o. I mean, not likely to be fazed. You know, the fact of the matter is, John McCain has a hellish temper, and he has little control over it.
Yeah. And I think that that has probably won him the most points in those that weren't sold, has been watching him through this. And McCain is very much all over the place. And the we could never have called the timing of this, but this whole economic, just vomit that's taking place is now shifting the people's priorities. They're looking at things from as a whole from a very different perspective. And McCain not talking about the economy is like shooting himself in the foot.
Well, and all he had this evening, John, was, "My friends, I know you're hurting out there. I know you've got pain," but it was a sort of academic approach to it. It didn't ring with any genuineness. It didn't ring with any authenticity. How can he know how America is hurting? How can a guy who's got 15 cars and 13 houses, how can he know if America's hurting?
Yeah, and I think you're hitting on the crucial point there, Bob, is, you know, the American people, I think it's obvious to most that these two guys, however, you know, kind of affluent they may be now, one is very much closer to the rest of the American people in just timeline. You know, I mean, Obama's new to that game. He knows what it's like to be a lot of Americans. And he looks like what America is becoming. And I think just to look presidential and to look cool and under control and not jumping off the bloody, you know, cliff every time something happens, and just sitting there and being cool, calm, collected, taking it in, and then making a thoughtful statement about it and talking to the American people like adults. I think it's working.
I think it is, but I just checked over to a couple of the live blogs on it. Apparently the Associated Press is already calling this debate for McCain. Because he was feisty? No kidding. Yeah, really. I tell you what, John, I'm really tickled. Another of our comrades here at the Horn is on the line right now. Mark Levine joins us from Washington, D.C. Hello, Mark.
Hello, hello.
How are you?
Hey, Mark.
I'm good. I'll tell you what I think Saturday Night Live is going to make fun of this Saturday, and that is all the faces that John McCain was making. I don't know if you all have discussed
it.
But the split screen killed McCain, and it reminded me actually of something that hurt Al Gore in 2000. The infamous
size.
If you notice, when when John McCain was talking, Obama, you know, he wasn't happy about some of the things, but he looked and he was calm and he was respectful. And John McCain had the twitches. He was just constantly twitch, you know, and even at the end there, I don't know if you caught.
Oh, I'm blinking like a barn owl too.
Well, yeah, and then he like is clowning around on stage. He has a juvenile tendency, which is incredibly ironic for a much older man, of just not keeping still. He just didn't look presidential. I mean, it's funny. You know, to me, that was actually the worst thing he... I mean, in addition to always being on the attack, whereas Obama was always talking about what he would do for the American people, and McCain was always talking about what a bad guy Obama was. And Obama very calmly answered all the silliness, and I thought Obama did a terrific job. Now, McCain was better, I have to admit, than he was in the second debate, where I thought he was just awful. But I still think Obama clearly won the debate tonight.
Well, you know, before you rang in, Mark, I had just initiated a discussion, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. It seems that the theory or the theme, if you will, for Obama was to continue looking presidential and to be utterly unflappable in the face of all the airs and acorn business,
right,
without being snarky or snipey in his own right. In other words, to appear
above the fray.
Above the fray and a better man than Lumpy McHoover.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, however, I am a little bit disturbed, I have to say, by virtue of the fact that he, and maybe it was just deemed to be not significant, but John McCain did force him to explain,
right,
the heirs and the acorn relationship, and you know, I don't. Well, and by doing so, violated one of those, and I, God forbid that I should actually agree with anything this horrid little man said, but there is an element of truth in it, violated one of those Rovian truisms, and that is, if you're explaining, you're losing.
You know, I think his explanations were brief. I mean, it's hard. He puts the charge out there, and you've either got it. I mean, look. You know, I've debated a lot of Republicans, as listeners know. I regularly bring the bastards on air, something that is incredibly controversial also. Some listeners love it, some listeners hate it. And when they throw out a charge that's untrue, and that's what they do, they are Republicans after all, you're put in a bind. There's sort of three things you can do. You can respond truthfully to the charge, which, yeah, makes you look defensive. You can give a counter charge back. This would be the equivalent of Obama saying, yeah, what about the Keating Five?
Or, hey, let's talk about William Timmons a little bit.
Right. Oh, and the third option is to say, you know what, you're being silly, you're being negative. Let's talk about the issues that affect the American people. Obama chose options one and three, didn't do any of two, and I think that's okay, despite the fact that there's lots of two to do, lots of counterattacks.
But that's,
you know,
what we're for.
Five. Well, I mean, if he'd done that, he would have gone down into the gutter with McCain. So even though all those things were out there, and it's something that maybe Joe Biden could do or others can do, MoveOn.org can do it, I think Obama was right not to do the counter charges, because that, I think, brings him down to his level. As far as defending himself, he had to answer the charges. I mean, he really had no choice but to say, and I think he answered them really well. William Ayers was the guy that Chicago Tribune and Walter Annenberg and all. So, you know, it's Fox News and everyone had made such a big deal out of it that I think spending 5-10 minutes just answering it all and making it look silly and petty, it was the right way to respond.
Yeah, and, well, frankly, Mark, it's not going to have any impact at all on the little knuckle-dragging, mouth-breathing, right-wing repig-lickens who have long since been convinced of any number of the blood libels that have been spread on Obama.
Yeah, but who cares? They're not going to vote for him anyway.
Right. So they're not going to vote for him anyway. But there are people, Lord knows why or how, who are on the fence. And I wonder sometimes how constantly taking a man's punches and never, and I mean, you know, he sat there in one question and let John McCain call him a liar to his face twice.
I think, to me, it looked like the, you know, if you're out, I don't know if you have you ever been to Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park, Bob. You ever been to?
Elitist.
Okay. I'm an elitist. What can I say? I've been to London, and there's this corner of Hyde Park.
And I've been to Fraser's Bottom, West Virginia.
There you go. Where it's called Speaker's Corner. It's a wonderful British tradition, and anyone and everyone can get up on their little stoops and spout about whatever you want to spout about. And people either gather around or ignore you or heckle you. It's it's free speech at its finest. We could use something like that in the United States. In any case, I have done that. I know that will shock all of you that I actually stood up on a stoop and started spouting.
No, not you.
That's not my character. But in any case, I did that. And, you know, there are, if you will, reasonable hecklers and unreasonable hecklers. And the reasonable ones, you know, might ask you a question or make a tough comment, and those are the ones that you want to respond to. They draw blood, if you will, and if you need to respond to them, otherwise it hurts. And then there are the people who are just crazy and, you know, spouting off all kinds of ridiculous things that it's not worth your time to respond. People realize that they're crazy, and if you respond to them, you just go down to their level. I think to some extent, Barack Obama sort of looked on some of those attacks with bemused indifference, like, oh, there he goes again. And I think that was the right response. I mean, I don't know that he could have done any more except go down to his level, which I think was not the right strategy to do.
Well, I want
to... I'm curious to know what John thinks about it. John? Is he still there?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I just thought we've been seeing more of the same... you know, really, really stiff and seemingly false performance from McCain. Like, you know, I've been noticing that he's been really trying hard when he's at his events to get and believe me, I'm not trying to make fun here, because believe me, I have my own shoulder injuries, but I've been seeing him like really trying to, like, you know, get trying to make himself big and, you know, this attention thing. And then when he kind of postures, when he has one of his little killer lines, it's just so kind of so forced and fake and sounds so hollow, and you hear the
it's juvenile, the it's immature.
This is the thing. This is what I was trying to say before when you were going, Mark. Is, you know, how bizarre is this? Again, it's this opposite world, bizarre thing that's going on where the young guy looks
the young guy's cool,
like the adult.
the old guy is erratic and impulsive, and not exactly right.
Loony.
Yeah, and I just I really think we're hitting. I don't know if you heard about this, Mark, and I've got this. I mentioned it to Bob. Have you heard about Kevin Rudd's comments yesterday about?
I have not.
Out of control. Oh my God, man! I think I'm getting the impression that we might actually be having a serious global groundswell kind of happening, and so. Due to what's been going on, Kevin Rudd did something that I thought was, you know, I guess the smartest thing you can do. He took $10 billion of our $20 billion surplus. You know, we had this thing called a surplus. I actually had cash on hand. And he decided
we
to inject
to have
it
that.
In.
I remember in 2000, Bill Clinton gave us one of those. It was ancient history ago.
And you know, give credit where credit's due. A lot of that surplus is very much due to the previous government, but... This government decided, instead of giving it back in tax rebates and things like that, they kind of saw that we're on slightly uncertain times, environmental things like that. Look, we're just going to kind of hold on to it for a little while, and we're going to stick it back in the future fund. And he kind of came out and he said, look, the rainy day has come. Now, he goes and then busts into the National Press Club address. He wasn't even the scheduled speaker, and he pops up and he says, this just kills me. What we have seen is the comprehensive failure of extreme capitalism. Extreme capitalism, which now turns to government to prevent systematic failure, Rudd told the National Press Club in Canberra. Governments around the world, around the industrialized world, have pumped billions of dollars into the financial system. He's just pumped $10.4 billion into our system. He said dealing with greed, which has caused the fear, will come after that. And he talks about the fact that named greed and fear as the twin evils at the root of the financial sector collapse. Smack.
Yeah, no kidding.
And this is as he's going out there and selling. He's sitting there going, so, you know, thanks to the last government, we've got this. And here we're going to throw a bunch of money at pensioners, and we're going to throw a bunch of money into public projects and get people working now and put money in. And I love this. You're seeing this thing. We're going to put money in, but we're going to put it in from the ground up. And this is where Obama's, you know, New Deal 2.0 speech the other day, again, is another one of these, you know, injecting money. The markets have failed, so now the government has to step in. It has no choice. we run into these times in history for whatever reason. This time it's because, you know, we let the fake money system just go completely just uncontrolled. And I'm hoping that maybe we'll look at the way we actually create money in this country, because it is actually at the root of the problem.
It just seems to me that greed and fear, what you mentioned, John, I mean, that is the heart of the Republican Party. That's all they have left. It's all they have left. And nowhere was Obama stronger, in my view, than when he was talking about health care. I don't know if you watched on CNN like I did, but they had those little lines where they show people. And he was off the charts there. He was off the charts on education, too. But in health care, I don't know what world John McCain is living in. Maybe it's because he gets government-provided health care through the federal system the way all federal employees do, exactly what Obama...
Let's face it. John McCain has had a death grip on the federal teat from the day he was born.
Well, that's true. That is true.
And
has he never heard of a pre-existing condition? I mean, this idea that, okay, he's going to give us $5,000, tax credit... That's not health care. That's not a health care rebuttal. That's
more.
And it damn sure doesn't help you buy a policy if you've got a pre-existing condition.
Yeah, Mark, how can you ask that question? He's a walking, pre-existing condition.
Well, exactly. But he's lucky he gets the federal plan. Because that is the beauty of Barack Obama's plan. The federal government doesn't discriminate in its health care plan if you have a pre-existing condition. Virtually everyone else does.
Bingo. Exactly.
So there you go. There's an issue where he and his running mate agree that, it's like they talked about, their great health care, when they got a union job.
Well, hey, let me throw a little something out there. We had some emails in from our pal Cindy in the Great Northwest over the course of the programming. She said, you know what I notice about this debate? Not. McCain is talking about Obama in front of Obama, but will not talk to Obama. His behavior is effete. Inane and stupid, yes, but effete too. Then he throws in some talking points. Obama's speaking to Bob Schieffer, to McCain, and the American people, loud and clear. Dancing intellectual circles around Grandpa. And she also noted a couple of other things. She said that she caught Obama's reference to clean coal, which, just drives me and likely you, John, straight through the roof. She said it angered me. We're going to have to educate him, and I've got just the right person to do it, Bobby Kennedy, and she's absolutely correct. And then with regard to...
But he's educable, which is the beauty of...
Bingo, he is. He can be taught.
Right. Right. He's willing to listen to others. He doesn't fly off the handle. He's willing to listen to his advisors.
And then finally, with regard to Lumpy McHoover's declaration that he wants to bring unaccredited instructors into schools, Cindy says, you just don't understand Grandpa, Bob. What he said was we could save money by hiring non-credited instructors because they can't tell when the students aren't learning, so they'll get passed, and it'll look like everything's hunky-dory. And then finally she throws in, because at one point, you'll remember Lumpy said, my friends, I'll be a good steward of your money. And Cindy points out that steward is one of those churchy words. It's another one of those telegraphs to the fundies. Because, they're big on using that word, stewardship. We've got to be a good steward of the church, and that's why you need to dig deep when the plate's coming around. We got to be stewards.
And the irony is, and this relates back to my show today, those of you that were listening to the Inside Scoop today, if not, you know where to find the archive. I'll just give a pitch, radioinsidescoop.com. But if you listen to my show today...
Or whiterosesociety.org.
There you go, whiterosesociety.org as well. What I talked about is I am generally a fiscal conservative. I believe in pay-as-you-go. I believe in the Blue Dog Democrats. I believe in budget surpluses under Bill Clinton in 80-90% of situations, but not now. Not now. Not when you face a Great Depression. This is the one time when a spending freeze is extremely dangerous. It's exactly what Hoover did. He contracted the economy at a time of depression, and he took a stock market falling down in 1929, which it does on occasion, and turned it into the Great Depression. As I talked about on my show today, this is an ironic situation where we're in this trouble because of massive debt, wasteful spending on things like the Iraq War and tax cuts to the rich and so forth. But notwithstanding all of that, until we get out of this depression, yeah, we got to go into more debt. Yeah, we need more spending. Now, I hope it's productive spending, not on a war, but on things like infrastructure and
a green economy.
By the way, Obama was great on that. When he talked about cars and how we have to make Detroit do the right thing, he was solid on that. He's like, well, you know, they're really hurting right now. Maybe they should have done the right thing in the future. Maybe we need to help them do that.
Well, this I want to go to another topic in a minute, if I could, guys, that does reflect back to what you were talking about in your show today. And it's something that I mentioned to you, John, early in the debate. But just a couple of fun things from out and around the blogosphere and from the for-profit media that's covering the way they covered it. On CNN, their little focus group, you know, the one that has the green lines that look like John McCain's flatline heart attack going underneath, their focus group gave the debate to Obama by a score of 15 to 10, and three people in the focus group changed their minds as to how they would vote based on the debate, and all three decided to vote for Obama.
Yeah. No, I mean, Obama's going to win. Because, you know, maybe the Associated Press is looking at scoring point. Ooh, McCain mentioned William Ayers. And like you said, Bob, he's on the defensive, Karl Rove's point. People are beyond that now. Maybe that would work in 2004 in the time of swift voting. But not in this economy.
Oh, by the way, Lumpy McHoover also blew the name of Joe the Plumber. That's why I kept calling him Joe the Plumber afterward.
I didn't know that. That's great.
Joe the Plumber, who actually does make in excess of $250,000 a year.
For it to be part of the, you know, discussion.
And bear in mind that this guy, now, this is kind of a crass phrase, but an old buddy of mine, it's one of his phrases, Joe the Plumber is not a turd chaser. He's a guy who is sending other people out to do that.
Of course. He's not doing the dirty work would be a nicer way of saying it.
Right, but I'm not nice.
Kincaid.
But anyway, Joe the Plumber's real name is Joe Wurzelberger. Say it, everybody. You try it, John. Wurzelberger.
Wurzelberger.
Mark?
It'd be kind of hard to forget
Wurzelberger.
That.
Well, Lumpy McHoover called him Joe Wurzelbacker.
You know, if you're gonna, and this is such a pre-planned thing too. Obviously, he had planned the whole thing in advance. If you're gonna plan your whole speech around a guy, you think you could remember his name?
Well, there's that, it was pre-planned, Mark, because the official tally is 15 mentions of Joe the Plumber by Lumpy McHoover, 5 by Barack Obama.
The amazing was that Obama seemed to remember the guy. I mean, that was impressive. Here he was surprised with one guy. I mean, Obama's met, I'm sure, hundreds of thousands of Americans over the course of his campaign, and Obama remembered him. Good for him. But did you notice, by the way, the first time that Joe the Plumber, Wurzelberger, see, I remembered, came up, was in response to a non-answer to a question. Basically, it was about where would you cut spending, where would you cut the deficit, and Obama gave his answer. And then McCain started just going off. And even Schieffer had to even say, you know, but that wasn't the question. And as it was happening, my nephew's in town, and he and I both looked at each other, and we both said, Palin-esque. You know, if you can't answer a question, push button C3 on the jukebox and play that memorized tune.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what
default
he did.
Track.
I'm Mavericky. Yeah.
Well, I'm over at CBS News, and their Insta net poll thingamajiggy says Barack Obama won it by 86-12, with only 1.77% saying it was a draw.
Well, but that's because all the fundies and right wingers are watching Fox News, where I'm sure McCain won it 86-12. So you know those polls don't mean anything.
The chat room, I think, said Fox on Air was calling it for Obama.
Fox did call it for Obama.
No way.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Wait a minute. This totally blows my whole sense of everything. I'm shocked.
Mark, welcome to Opposite World. I've been trying to tell you this like the last three times we've talked. We're in another dimension at the moment. It won't be over until November 5th.
Britt Hume was.
I can't explain it. I'm not usually the last word.
Brit Hume was running
Obama.
Brit Hume was running the circus on Fox News, and they had a focus group put together, of course, by none other than Frank Luntz.
Well, they had a focus group call it for Obama. Now that I believe.
And the focus group on Fox said that Obama won, and the data on that, four members of Frank Luntz's 23-person focus group switched to Obama. Nobody switched to McCain, and Mark Ambender over at thinkprogress.org says that Brit Hume did not seem happy to learn that.
Okay, that's different. That at least is understandable in my universe. They got people from outside, and the people from outside said Obama won. Okay, now that I get. For a second, I thought you were saying that Brit Hume called it for Obama, at which point my brain was about to explode. So I'm very glad that you protected me from that.
Well, you know, we don't that sickening popping sound is just not good radio, Mark.
I am no longer at a loss for words. I now understand the context. Okay, that makes sense to me.
Go ahead, John.
Go ahead, Bob. Oh, okay. David from Maine's just popped in, and he's just actually sent me this. You can actually hear it for yourself.
This threat to our economic security in a generation. In the last few weeks, the global financial crisis has moved into a new and dangerous stage. But this is a crisis that has been unfolding now for some 15 months. Its origins go back to the beginning of this decade with the collapse of the dot-com boom. US authorities responded with aggressive cuts in interest rates. That opened up an era of cheap debt that was accompanied by increasing financial complexity and a greater appetite for risk. Financial products, from basic subprime home loans to complex financial derivatives, were built on the shallow foundations of a cheap debt economy. Loans were advanced to millions of people, especially in the United States, with no realistic prospect of ever being repaid. And those loans were financed through complex financial products that were understood by neither investors nor by regulators. The balkanization of risk, the attenuation of risk, sought the impossible dream of the elimination of risk and responsibility, so that ultimately nobody believed they carried the risk or the responsibility. And through it all, the ratings agencies blessed these products as safe investments, ratings agencies that have yet to face their own day of reckoning. And the products they sanctioned continued to proliferate. Credit default swaps also played an important role in the excessive underwriting of high-risk mortgages. The ability and willingness of providers of credit default swaps to offer cheap insurance against counterparty risk exaggerated the credit worthiness of the assets and the counterparties that backed them to the final investors. This mix of cheap credit and cheap insurance.
I love politicians that speak to people like adult guys. I just think it is.
Oh, you know,
what we're continue to see.
You're absolutely right, John. The other day on Guy James's show, he played one of Franklin Roosevelt's radio addresses. In that radio address, and it just floored me, it just dropped me. In that radio address, FDR implored the American people to read and study the Constitution of the United States. He begged them to educate themselves on the structure of our government. And, you know, that's patriotic, learning how your government works. On the other hand, Lumpy McHoover tonight, I don't know if you caught this one or not, but he said, my friends, if you like Obama's health care plan, and this is a quote, you'll love Canada or England.
Yeah.
Well, I do love Canada and England.
Exactly. As if the worst possible thing in the world is to be compared to Canada and England. Those are two pretty good countries.
I do, too, and it speaks to an essay that I read on air as we were getting started this evening. And there's a line in there about how the same people who scream terrorist and kill him and off with his head and bomb Obama are the same people who don't travel and won't get a passport because you know, there's something fundamentally icky and un-American about learning a foreign language or going abroad. And it's true. I mean, that's again, and it's another case of what Cindy was talking about, of telegraphing things. You know, those English, those Canadians. Yeah, if he could have, he would have worked in a dodge, a jab, whatever, one of those snide, snarky little crappy comments he's so good at the French. But it's kind of tough to do since they're bleeding and dying with us in Afghanistan.
I was surprised that wasn't mentioned. That's standard Republican lore. I, you know, he must have forgotten that one. He meant to.
Now, here's another surprise for you. You want to talk about Fox? Mark, Charles...
Not usually, but okay.
Yeah, Charles Krauthammer on Fox said, and I quote, "It was a dead draw, which means Obama won resoundingly."
Well, that's one of the few honest things Krauthammer's ever said.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
You know, I think they're prepared to lose. Even my cohort, my local cohort, Mike Lane, we did a program, and he was going on and on and on, of course, about Bill Ayers, because that's all they have. And, you know, out of camera range, he said it's over.
You know this old proverb as well, or better than I do, Mark. Finish it for us. When you have the facts, pound on the facts. When you have the law, pound on the law. When you have neither,
pound on the man.
Pound on the table. Pound on Bill Ayers.
Oh. Okay. Well, no, because I thought you meant an inhabitant attack, because that's usually what you do when you don't have the facts or the law.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, just another little thing to throw out there. All this business about Joe the Plumber, Joe the Plumber, Joe the Plumber, Joe the Plumber. Well, the plumbers have a union.
The employers of the plumbers.
No, but the plumbers have a union. It's the United Association
of
Plumbers.
Plumber ain't a plumber. Plumber is an employer of plumbers.
Right, but the plumbers have a union. It's called the United Association of Plumbers and Pipe Fitters.
Of course they do.
Yeah, otherwise just generically referred to as the UA. And, of course, a long time ago, they endorsed Barack Obama. So this is actually, Joe the Plumber is not Joe the Plumber. Joe is Joe the Plumbing Contractor.
Exactly. He's Joe the Plumbing Company. He's Joe the Plumbing Corporation. He's Joe the Plumbing, businessman. The Plumbing Holding Company.
And see, one of the other fundamental dishonesties about all that Joe the Plumber business is that if, in fact, Joe the Plumber is a plumbing contractor and he hires members of the United Association, well, those guys already have excellent health care because they are members of an organized labor group, which John Lumpy McHoover despises.
Good point.
You know, Wayne, the boss, has pointed out on more than one occasion, you know, these problems seem so intractable. So many of these problems seem so intractable, but as is so often the case, if you just turn it around and look at it from another angle, it becomes solvable. If we manage to pass and enact into law the Employee Free Choice Act, and Americans, if they so desire to do, are able to easily organize and join a union, then almost overnight, a great deal of America's health care crisis disappears. Because organized labor has some of the best health care in the country. And it's health care that, for the most part, and Wayne might be able to correct me to one degree or another, but for the most part, that the government has not been able to destroy. Why do you think, guys, that Lumpy McHoover so desperately wants to tax people who have good health care plans? Because he would be taxing union health care plans.
I see.
That's
a good point.
Blind hog finds an acorn now and then, and I guess that's mine for the night.
Well, I wish Obama had pointed that out. That's a good one. You need to point that out to his campaign, I think.
Well, before we do wrap up, though, we've run a little past the top of the hour, but I do want to come back around because, like I said, I mentioned this to John at the beginning of the debate, and I want your take on it, Mark. A great deal of the first part of the debate was spent in talking about who was going to cut taxes more and better. And my remark to John at the time was that what we were seeing was the effectiveness of the Republican Party over the course of the last 38 years, and especially the last 28 years, in dramatically altering the terms of the debate.
Ask not what your country, what you can do for your country, ask what your country can do for you. That's the Republican mantra.
Or give to you.
Give to you, right. Chicken in every pot.
Yeah, they want to talk about, you know, tax and spend Democrats and social welfare states and everything. But the Republican Party at the end of the day is nothing but a big old fat hog with all 4 feet in the trough.
Yep.
And so, you know, there are real...
And Obama was smart not to fight that zeitgeist, not to, because the Republicans have won on that score. You can't tell the truth to the American people anymore. And that's and so you have to promise them everything. And luckily, it happens to be the smart thing to do in the dramatic economic straits that we're in. But when good times come, we're going to have to pay back for all these Bush years. And that was why I did.
Well, what and what I want to ask you, Mr. Economics guy, put your economics hat on. The single, short of the Clinton years, and they had their, you know, wrinkles and problems, but for working class America and for upper class America, one of the single best eras of this country was the, economically speaking, not racially, not civil rights, not anything, but purely in terms of pay, was the 50s, and when the union membership was at its height, 33%. But more importantly, when progressive income tax rates were dramatically higher.
That's right.
Are the American people so stupid that they can't see it? Or are we so afraid of the ability of the right-wing slime, sleaze, and general hate machine to get the message out louder and more persistently that we can't talk about that? I mean, we're, you know, the progressive income tax, what was, you might know, Mark, what was the income tax rate?
70% for the highest tax bracket under the, in the Eisenhower years. It was 70%. In the wartime, during World War II, it was over 90% for the highest tax bracket. Then it was lowered after World War II. It was 70%. Kennedy actually ran on cutting it, and he cut it to 50%.
Right. And then, you know, like you noted, LBJ busted that bubble
right.
with his stupid little war in Vietnam. Not entirely his, but the escalation was his. And, you know, we pretty much acknowledge that he has
point.
To take ownership of it.
As I pointed out on today's show, between the 50s following a war, let's face it, as bad as Vietnam and Iraq were, they don't compare to World War II in lives lost, in money spent, in war effort. I mean, you know, World War II, war I think was definitely one we had to fight, but was the granddaddy of them all. And yet the 50s were a great time for the economy, whereas the two decades following the wars we shouldn't have fought were not. And that's not because World War II was just and Vietnam and Iraq weren't. That's true, but that's not the reason. The reason is precisely that FDR raised taxes to pay for World War II, and Lyndon Johnson and George Bush, knowing the wars were unpopular, didn't want to do that. And the economy suffered for a decade after. The 70s, I'm afraid, is going to repeat itself in the teens.
Well, and that was my next question. Is that going to hit the United States? And, John, if that hits the United States, will it translate to the rest of the world?
Well, this is where it's
key. Both questions.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of interesting. I a couple weeks ago, I ran into the global head of economics for Westpac Bank, and I kind of pulled him over for a second and got talking about this very thing. And it was on the day, and I actually wasn't aware of this at the time, it was on the day that the Australian markets had lost 14% or something in the opening 10 minutes. And he talked about Australia's banks have just been rated as tied for second as the world's best and most solid. So, like, as far as our cash on hand kind of thing, we're in really, really good shape. Deposits are fine. Rudd's just done a thing going, yeah, I'll guarantee all deposits in Australia. It's fine. It's cool. And came up with a couple of these measures because we do actually have – something solid. We actually have cash, real cash on hand. So I asked him, I said, well, if we're cool there, where are we vulnerable? And he said, the problem is because Australia kind of boxes above its weight in the world market. It relies on the world market to buy credit to sustain its short-term credit market. And its short-term credit market is the stuff where, you know, the contractor guy gets, you know, the 90 days credit to pay for, you know, supplies, gear, and labor while he waits to, you know, while he completes a job. And that's where, you know, so like our – and the other crucial thing was just as the Australian bank started barely playing in the subprime game was when the cracks started to show in the United States. So the Australian regulators and the Australian banks all just like went, well, no, we're not going to play there. Macquarie took a huge hit, wrote off a couple of billion dollars from memory, and that was kind of all we heard about that. So they stayed completely clear of that problem, thankfully. And so it's more dealing with, you know, if some businesses will be exposed because they expose themselves. And Kevin Rudd has been working to more aid, make Australia much more Asia-centric over the past few months than U.S.-centric. And I think he's been making the right moves.
I want to close by coming full circle to what I said at the beginning of my show today, where I talked about Joseph's dream in the Bible, the one where it's actually the Pharaoh's dream. I should get that right.
Yeah, Joseph interpreted it. I'm surprised I have to remind you of this.
It's your book. I corrected myself. Anyway, Pharaoh's dream, the one about the seven fat cows devoured by the seven lean cows, and Joseph's interpretation, which is that in good years, you got to save for bad years, which is obviously not solely in the Bible. It's a general principle that I think is in all cultures and should be, you know, the grasshopper and the ant, whatever you want. The point is that in this case, Australia saved its fat cows for a lean cow day, and America didn't. And that's the reason why Australia will weather this crisis much better than we. Unfortunately, in this case, we're a lot bigger than Australia. And so we're going to take you folks down. And as an American, I just want to be the first to apologize for that.
Well, I'll tell you, Mark, I won't get into the long version of the story, but I actually had someone take a swing at me in the financial district of Sydney when all this was falling apart. And I was out doing a job on the street trying to interact with people, and just the mere sound of my accent, I think, was just a bad vibe at this time in history.
Well, you just have to remind him that we Americans voted for the other guy, and it wasn't our fault that our Supreme Court chose Bush.
Yeah, and I took comfort in just thinking, you know, the irony is, if these people had any idea, I've been railing about this for years.
Exactly. Maybe you need one of those T-shirts with "I didn't vote for that moron" in all the UN languages.
Yeah, that's a good.
Hi, ask me about what I think about fractional reserve lending.
but let's look at the optimistic side. I think it's extremely likely we're going to have a new president that can finally start to dig us out of this. We're going to have some tough years. We got to pay for the horrific reign of Bush Jr. But at least we're going to stop digging and start getting out of that hole.
Well, I'll tell you what, guys, before we do wrap things up, we do have a call coming through, so I don't want to not take that. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Juanita. I just wanted to ask a question, probably from Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I found out that my bank has a couple of other banks in the city, and they've closed down. What should you do if you try to... What should you do? Because mine is from the government. My money is from the government.
Yeah, no. As long as you don't have an account in any bank that's over $100,000, and frankly, they're going to.
I wish.
And I didn't think you did, but I wasn't going to presume. And they're actually going to expand $250,000. Your money is absolutely safe. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is one of those New Deal programs that comes from Franklin Delano Roosevelt that has worked dramatically well, and it's one reason why, while we are going to suffer some tough economic times, we will not have the Great Depression. We will never have the Great Depression again as long as these liberal, socialist, New Deal, democratic programs remain law in this country. So don't worry, you'll be fine. If some banks fail, they actually respond pretty quickly, the FDIC, usually in about a week.
Mine is direct deposit, you know, Social Security, direct deposit.
Yeah, well, you can just go to a different, all you do is contact Social Security Administration and ask to go to a different bank. But if your money, and you'll get your money back from. Did your money in the bank fail? Is it your bank that failed, or is it?
I don't know if it failed or not. I just
I'm sure you would
have closed. Two of their substations have closed.
If branches have closed, that doesn't mean
branches.
The bank.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean the bank has failed. That just means you may have to go to another branch. Look online or something. Call the company. Call the bank.
And my problem, I can't get another bank account because of my credit rating.
Well, I would look on, if the bank has a website, I would look on there, find out what branches are open, call its toll-free number, and find out. And if the bank failed, then you'd contact the FDIC, or probably they would contact you. My understanding is, and I've never had money in a failed bank, but my understanding is they're pretty quick about it and pretty good about it. It's one of the few government agencies that works really well.
Okay.
Wow. Thank you, Juanita.
All right. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Y'all have a good evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we have more or less come full circle, guys, and with that in mind, I want to close by getting, because I mentioned this before either of you were on the air, and I'd like to get your thoughts. I mentioned at the beginning when I came on late that one of the things that I did while I was out this evening, being tardy to the microphone, was that I went into the local pharmacy to see if a prescription had been filled. And as I walked in, the pharmacist, who I know to be a fundamentalist, was haranguing with the other person behind the counter, and he said, blah, 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 blah. And he said, and he turns to me as I walk up to the counter and said, isn't that right? And, it's one of those gags in rural communities. You know, you don't know what they're doing. Isn't that right? And you just go, oh, yeah, sure. You betcha. And the guy said, no, really. I mean, that's what the liberals want. They want to socialize this country. They're going to take us on the road to socialism. Now, this is my pharmacist.
Liberals like George Bush?
And I didn't go there immediately. He said, do you want to go to socialism? He looks at me and says, I said, be fine by me. Driving on socialized roads, got socialized utilities. Got George Bush, John McCain got the best socialized health care in the world. Banks been socialized. I'm all for it. And then he kind of backed up and he said, but we don't need socialized medicine. I said, well, there's about 47 million Americans that might disagree with you. Well, everybody in this country gets treatment. We give away free medicine all the time.
He's a pharmacist?
Yeah.
Then
I looked at him and said, does Rite Aid know you're doing that?
How you paying?
And then, but then he does this other right wing thing that just drives me batty. Nobody has ever been turned away from an American emergency room. People get free medical care all the time.
It's not true.
And I said they get free medical care for stable. He said it's a matter of. The law says they got to. I said. The law says they have to be stabilized. It doesn't say they have to be treated on a long-term basis. They can be stabilized and dumped.
Michael Moore's movie, which I'm sure he never would.
No, no, because that's a communist.
He had to choose between two fingers. I mean,
But I thought Obama addressed it very nicely tonight because he said something that will speak to the right-wingers, the economic right-wingers, not the, you know, the fundies and the knuckle-draggers and the people who think that blah, blah. He said, the people who do receive free medical care at hospitals drive the cost up for the rest of us.
That's true. Yeah. Because you know what? A quintuple bypass emergency heart surgery is a lot more expensive than a couple of blood pressure drugs, medication.
Well, there's that, or teaching someone, like perhaps me, to change their diet and quit mainlining the cheese dip. Maybe that
or
helps.
Quit smoking, Bob.
Listen, I wouldn't have been as huffing and puffing as you were this afternoon trying to run into your studio.
I was climbing stairs. This is slander.
Yeah, you climb stairs and you...
That's all you've got. Negative campaigning. That's all you have.
You climb stairs and you sound like an 84-year-old man huffing for his next breath.
Six flights of stairs.
Oh, uphill. Yeah, uphill both ways. Tell it to the Marines, Mark.
In the snow.
I know. I gotta quit smoking someday. And I will.
Yeah, you do. We'll talk about that later. We're going way over here. I don't want to.
Well, we haven't. Actually, we haven't.
On a happy note.
We actually haven't hit the 3 hour mark, but it's the 3 hour mark. I guess. Let's be clear here. But at any rate, thanks for joining in, Mark. It's always fun. And after you hang up, John and I will talk about you a little bit.
Sounds good. I'll hang up then. Bye.
All right. Take care, Mark.
See you, Mark.
Hey, you'll be live tomorrow, right? No, darn it. Too quick on the draw. Yeah, I think he will be live tomorrow evening. Agnes will produce him. And just for people listening, I plan on being live tomorrow night myself. I will be at a reception associated with the Society for Environmental Journalists in Roanoke, Virginia, that is being hosted by the Alliance for Appalachia. And there should be a lot of really cool people to talk to there, and I hope that there are. I'm going to take the 30-foot mic cord. And if I have to,
okay.
I'll get out and do person in the room stuff. If they, you know, if Muhammad cannot come to the mountain will come to Muhammad. And I'm a mountain.
Go, Bob.
So I'm really looking forward to that, and then hopefully be back on the air per normal on Friday evening. But I've got a little intermezzo on Friday afternoon. Check this out. Apparently Barack Obama is going to be appearing in Roanoke, Virginia.
Oh.
And I think we're just going to drop in and see him. And
that
we'll wear our
cool.
And maybe we'll wear our end mountaintop removal T-shirts that says "Save the Endangered Hillbilly" on the back.
Mm, what time of day is that event?
That will be apparently the show. The doors open at 10 a.m. and the show begins at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time.
Mm.
So with any luck at all, we'll I don't know, at least get some pictures or something. I'll be you know, because Roanoke, that's pretty close to coal country, and I want to see want to place a friendly wager, John. How many minutes into his speech before he starts talking about the glories of clean coal?
Well, you know, I think it's just one of those things that in the environment in this election you'd have to, if nothing else, pay lip service. And, you know, I've heard enough discussions on the subject where I also hear that, you know, we have to look at everything, and then what works is what will get
pushed.
Future funding and development. So it's, you know, a little bit of that, okay, yeah, we haven't really looked at any of this seriously yet, so, you know, we'll go and look at everything, and then when we see where we see results, we kick in more. And where we don't see results, we stop kicking in. And I think, you know, it's one of those things, we've been waiting to have these discussions for so long, we got to remember that that is kind of the normal process of changing people's mind.
And one last thing before we do go, since we're talking about coal, and I couldn't help a couple of interjections there during the course of the so-called debate. And that is the fact that, Lumpy McHoover said, and my friends, Sarah Palin will especially understand the needs of autism because she has a special needs child. Well, Sarah Palin's special needs child has Down syndrome, not autism. But you wonder how many people caught that.
And, you know, I mean, it's just such a hollow ploy for... And I'm sorry. The President of the United States and that decision is more important than the fact.
But, I mean, isn't the science, isn't the medicine pretty solid, John, that mercury is really bad for little babies' brains?
Oh, yeah.
Or is that just one of those situations where the Repiglicans get away with it by saying, well, we're not sure if autism is man-made or not. The science
is still out. As Rachel Maddow said the other night when Palin was, you know, trying to rewrite about the report on Troopergate, you know, there are certain things that aren't, you know, there's no need for discussion of context. The facts are just the facts, and a liar is just a liar, and sometimes you just need to say what it is.
Well, exactly. And by the way, you know, I'm sure you saw the story where Lumpy McHoover is in fact going to go back on Letterman's show.
Oh, I can't wait. Is that tonight? Or is that tomorrow night? That's tomorrow night.
I think it's tomorrow night. Well, it's my Friday night, your tomorrow night, something like that. I'm not sure. Or maybe right. It's tomorrow night, mine time. Maybe it's later tonight for you.
Because I for some reason, night after the debate is what strikes me. And he's making him record at a special time.
Right.
Which, if he doesn't show, look out, yeah. Lumpy.
But I have a larger philosophical question here, John.
Yes.
He's doing this because David Letterman has worn him out since he stood Dave up like a cheap date. David Letterman has forced Lumpy McHoover to schedule an appearance. Now, if David Letterman, for whom I have a tremendous amount of respect as an entertainer and as a damn smart guy and has real fine taste in automobiles, but he's an entertainer. He's David Letterman. If David Letterman can shove around Lumpy McHoover, what the hell are we supposed to expect when the guy sits down across from Vladimir Putin?
Well, I think one of the things that I love about Dave and what I think makes him, you know, more than just an entertainer in a way, is he is kind of classic that he's an amazing wealth of knowledge of pop culture. So that includes, you know, sport and the things that actually are important, you know, are important when kind of talking about the things that hold a society together, you know, those things through history. And, you know, he's been around. And McCain even launched his campaign on his show. I mean, just the blind stupidity, the fact that no one in the McCain camp thought more than 3 seconds about, you know, and when you're backing out, knowing that you're actually not going back to Washington and you're going down to go and appear on the same network.
I know.
And well, so Dave pulling his whole, you know, something stinks here. I think he said out loud what a lot of people in the nation were thinking. And so then Dave just has been unleashing. So McCain has absolutely no choice but to appear. And in the scariest format. Because
and grovel.
And you know, Overman said this, you know, unlike in a show like Overman's where the dynamic is different, in there it's about you know, not about policy and what's said, but about personality when you do those kind of appearances. And so there's a whole lot less control of what goes down. And I think I could see Dave very, very cleverly pin John McCain down on a couple of things and just say, you know, come on, man, how long have I known you? And you do this?
Yeah. And, of course, it is being taped at a special time. Again, another friendly wager. What do you want to bet the McHoover camp tries to load the audience?
They'll probably do that. I would think Letterman's probably got it under control. I bet he's got his people making sure that it's an honest audience. But they'll try. They'll try for sure. And, you know, if... The other thing, too, is if they load it, they could end up making complete asses of themselves on national television if they do something untoward.
Well, it should certainly be interesting. And
potential,
I don't know.
Potential for disaster is there.
Show will be over by tomorrow evening. Mine will, so maybe I'll get to check it out a little bit. Well, John, again, this was great. Thanks for providing the audio feed. It was certainly...
No whackers?
I got to work on getting some TV into the studio. You know, another one of those things to do in my many incredibly bored moments in this, my life of indolent leisure.
Are they doing digital TV down by you?
Oh, not here. We don't know. No. Our cable company abandoned us. At the foot of the mountain,
No. Digital free-to-air.
Oh, they will. They will. But the only station that we'll be able to receive is this horrible, atrocious little ABC affiliate that is you know, not the good ABC like you got, the bad ABC, you know, the mouse.
We're going to go fully digital. The analog system's just going.
Well, we are, too, as of February. HD to work.
So you're going to just have no. You're going to have no free to air television.
No, we will, but you'll have to either buy a converter box, which there's a government program to help you buy, or you've got to have an HD digital compatible television.
Oh, because we bought one for like $70 at an Aldi grocery store, and stuck an LCD screen on it, an instant widescreen TV.
Wow. We'll have it, but we won't have any kind of reception because TVs, it's kind of tough to get in the hills. As far as cable's concerned, we're also in the dark ages because there's digital cable at the bottom of the mountain and there's digital cable across the river, but they haven't quite figured out how to get the cable across the river to this part of the county. Because we're what I call non-Fayette, which stands for north of the New River, non-Fayette.
Okay.
Yeah, it's in the next county. It's at the foot of this mountain, but nope, sorry, can't get across the river here.
And you're here, and you're not quite there.
Yeah, they can get it across the river at the bottom of the mountain, but they can't get it up the mountain, and they can't get it across the New River Gorge. I mean, they're flummoxed, they're stymied, they're just stumped.
Yawn. How boring.
Yeah. Well, it would be nice because right now the only thing I've got in the way of a news channel is Fox. Yeah, no Olbermann, no MSNBC, no CNN, no Headline News, no CNBC, no nothing. No Bloomberg, I mean nothing. Zip.
You're like me, you do it all by the web.
Well, I do. I mean, it's compelled me to become a more savvy gatherer, more savvy news consumer on the internet.
Before we go, I do have to ask, did you see Rachel Maddow's confrontation with David Frum?
Yeah, I opened the show with it last night. That, you know, and what I said is that, you know, it kind of sort of was a needle into my essential Southern boyness, cuz you know, when you see somebody as sweet as Rachel Maddow and a freak like Frum trying to talk down to her, you know, you just want to hit him till the spit flies like a good hook from Ali, you know.
Oh, but you know what? You know.
Oh, she held her own just fine. It's not like she sniffled and cried.
Oh no, but and this is why I think I'm so glad that she's in the position that she's in, because she's such a great example for women, for liberals, for the media, you know, not afraid to go at it, but always respectful, always, you know, above the fray, you know, in a way, but not afraid to go there and not afraid at the end to say, you know what, I couldn't disagree with you more. Hope you had a good time. And I'm like, you know, more ideas. Thank you very much. We need to be talking about ideas. And that's where the hypocrisy of Frum trying to equate what she does with the kill him rhetoric stuff that was going on.
Even Falafel Boy O'Reilly. You know, you'll notice this guy wasn't out there beating that drum when there was no Olbermann and no Maddow. In typical Repiglican fashion, John, what he objects to is having to fight on a level playing field or something approaching level.
Absolutely. There's so much, you know, get off my grass, you damn kid. That just
well, yeah,
to
they
come
they
out
all,
of
you know,
pain.
Repiglicans only want to fight if they've got a couple of rolls of nickels in their mitt. And it's because they're essentially cowards and lowlifes.
Yeah.
But that does kind of wrap it up for this evening, John. Thank you so very much.
All right, man.
It was a heap of fun. And
that
was the last debate. We'll have to find another excuse to do this sometime soon. Election night we'll be doing it, I hope.
Oh, election night will be a gas. And I really do look forward to, I think there's going to be a moment. It could be late, and we're going to end up, and I'm sorry, the audio engineer is making a call here. When the election is called, we play Chocolate City. I'm sorry, I have to do it.
No, I'm down with you on that. Yeah.
And I think we need to play it then on a regular basis on the horn, you know, especially up and through Inauguration Day, just to annoy any, you know, right wingers that might be hanging about.
Be groovy by me. Well, all right. So that's the we've got that part of the part of the night's programming taken care of. You know, but Guy James will be with us. I'm sure Mark will be. You'll be here. Peter's free to join in if he wants to. We can have. You know, I'll extend an invitation to Rick Smith and Rick Goodner, Billy Shears, everybody on the network. And of course, you know, bloggers, listeners. I mean, you know, it'll be the absolute height of conversation radio, and I think it will be a blast. And frankly, if some of the I saw a number as I was going through all the blogging results and stuff. That CBS poll that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Golly, Ned. CBS poll of uncommitted voters said Obama was the winner by 53-22. Yeah, uncommitted voters. Okay. That's interesting. And, you know, God willing, you know, no whispering into the ears of the universe. But I said the other night that I want to see John McCain in the position. I want to see, figuratively speaking, I want to see a repeat of that brilliant photograph of Muhammad Ali standing with his guard down, but his fists clenched over the collapsed body of Sonny Liston. That's what I want to see the night of November the 4th.
Well, I tell you, Bob, one of my favorite visual representations out there is at 538, and it's their simulations. And the red is virtually disappeared from the entire display.
Yeah, and
in the number
and
of simulations
stupid.
where he even gets to a number that doesn't even reach even close to the 270.
Yeah, and stupid Lumpy McCoover may have gone a long way toward losing Alabama this evening, which I think would just be hilarious. He slimed George Wallace. And I got to tell you, there's a whole bunch of repiglickins and social conservatives down there to this day. Well, he was just misunderstood. That would just, it's too much to even hope for, but Lord God, wouldn't that just tickle me pink?
if it ended up being that and West Virginia, man, I think you will need resuscitation.
Well, I think we're gonna do West Virginia. I'm really confident. It might be closer than I'd like, but I think at the end of it all, we're gonna go back to our traditional Democratic ways.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you know, and Obama kind of set that tone after he became the candidate. He went over and said, "Hi, here's me and Mr. Dean."
Yeah.
I think that was still huge symbolism when he did that the very next day. It's just like, "Hi, this is not the DLC. This is the party. Hi, remember us?"
Exactly, exactly. Well, John, thanks a million, and we will talk to you soon.
Good night, mate.
All right, later.
All right, man.
Bye now. Don't forget, John Fox's All Foxed Up can be heard Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern Time right here on the Horn. And it is a fun, fun 3 hours. I think you'll like it. And it seems only fitting to close this broadcast this evening with the way that we began. From the essay by Tim Wise, "This is How Fascism Comes, Reflections on the Cost of Silence." The ultimate paragraph. If fascism doesn't come, if, rather, democracy does, it will come because good people said no. It will come because we saw in this moment the opportunity to demand the full measure of our humanity and to pour it forth upon the national soil. It will be because we understood that democracy isn't what you have, it's what you do. But if we are to issue that demand, if we are to stand straight and fulfill the potential we possess to do justice, we had best exercise the option quickly. For the opponents of justice are on the move. They are preparing to enter on the winds of our silence and indifference and complacency. Let them find no quarter. And that is as bold a clarion call to all of us as I can imagine. So thank you, everyone, for joining in. Thank you for listening by podcast, if that's what you do. Thank you, however it is that you choose to listen to these programs. Thank you to the people who contribute to keep the horn going. We are at halfway through October, and we aren't within, we can't see the halfway mark of our monthly fundraising goal. We're nowhere near even 1,000 of the 2,000 we try to raise every month. But to those of you who are trying, thank you so very much. Because as long as you try, we'll try. Thank you to everyone who tells people about the horn. To those of you who wish you could contribute but cannot, we thank you. Because others are trying to fulfill your wishes in what they generously contribute. Thank you for telling people. Thank you for calling. Thank you for emailing. Thank you for your ideas and your discussions, your passion and your compassion. Thank you for your blogging. Thank you for the efforts, your conversations in the chat room. Thank you to our moderators, Lottie and ELO, Sue. Thank you. Thank you very much to our blogger, Texas Betsy, the news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to everyone who is going out and trying to give, to let fascism have no quarter in this country. You may think, perhaps, that you act alone, but you have friends, you have comrades, and you have a community here that stands with you, shares with you, and loves you dearly for your fight. Thank you to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Not only the hardest working, but the hardest worked man in liberal talk. Every one of you who are listening to this program, no matter how you listen to it, are listening because of the diligent, dedicated, seemingly endless efforts of Ben Birch and WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to Peter Godbold, our IT professional, and of course John Fox, our chief engineer. Thank you to the bravest, hardest working people I know, people who for a long time have given no quarter to the rising tide of fascism, who don't merely talk it, but live it. The folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. And always, 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 RMR, Gina. It's all for you.